there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the number of people, the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%. That about a corresponding number at the other end of the scale are very, very difficult or almost impossible to hypnotize, and that in between there lies a large mass of people who can, with more or less difficulty, be hypnotized, they can gradually be, if you work hard enough at it, be got into the hypnotic state.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 10th of November 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. One called Horizon I downloaded onto my Android phone, so it's rather nice, and it does everything that Google Play does, but it's not Google Play, and it does actually allow you to download a lot of apps that the Google Play store is starting to ban, and you don't have to log in either. Yes, please, Horizon, that's the one. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda, the psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anybody with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the pre-war lies. So, helping us navigate through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also local freelance journalist Joe Banks. Joining us too is Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. So let's look at what we're going to be looking at this week. We'll definitely be taking a look at the King's Speech, the first one since George V. George VI, sorry, and also Charles's views on Gaza. He's just talking about foreign policy in the King's Speech a bit. But whilst Jeff's here, we're going to ask him a few questions about whether or not Bristol's going bankrupt. Lots of cities are going bankrupt these days. Is Bristol about to? There's also been news today about the Scunthorpe Foundry to go electric. The idea seems to be to get rid of any of the demand for coking coal to stop the new mine opening in Cumbria. Also, record NHS waiting lists, economy now officially in recession, and of course the protest in London tomorrow. In part two, we'll be focusing on Gaza and a bit of history, looking at Allenby's Battle of Gaza. This is in November 1917. And one of the things I've dug out over the last week, other people may have pointed this out too, is the fact that as Allenby kicked the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire versus the Ottomans at the time, in Palestine, just the end of that week that Allenby, the British general, booted out the Ottomans from Gaza. So, funnily enough, there's this little letter that was published in the Times called the Balfour Declaration just that week, as soon as we got them out of Gaza. So interesting, I think, that looking at the history of this. Also, I think we better start, particularly with Joe and Jeff being here, having to share a microphone, I'm afraid, but we'll see how we get on. Jeff, can you just say something about the budget? Because this is it's a budget for next year, for next April, but there's a lot of discussion about it this time of year, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and it's particularly relevant this year because the budget's being set under the mayoral system, so with the mayor in charge, but it's going to be operated under the committee system with committee chairman in charge. So it's even more critical that it's right, because the committee system is going to take a bit of time of settling in and bedding down. So what we've got is a medium-term financial plan, which is a sort of part of the jigsaw of putting the figures together, that shows in 2 years' time the projected spending gap is going to be £32 million on the City Council budget. If things went favourably, it could be less than that. If they go badly, it could be as much as £81 million. So the figures don't look good. But just taking your comments about bankruptcy, compared to councils that somewhat unwisely invested in shopping centres, for example, 3 or 4 years ago, Bristol, in spite of some fairly extravagant spends, hasn't done anything as ridiculous as that. So there's no indication that I'm aware of that it's in serious financial trouble.
I'll tell you one reason City Council might like to invest in a shopping centre is because during a recession they can charge very little or even no rent in order to make sure the place stays open. In a commercial world, that's not possible.
Yeah, and the philosophy of investing in things that can save the council money absolutely makes sense. But what, in fact, some of the bankrupt authorities did was they bought up shopping centres for the income they were going to generate, thinking that they could spend that on public services. And what's in fact happened is that the value of the shopping centres has fallen so massively that they're not worth the amount of money that was borrowed on them, and they have no means of repaying the debt. So that's where the problem lay there.
Is this the sort of thing you're doing, Jeff?
Certainly looking and questioning why decisions are being taken and whether and what the cost is of doing them. But if we're talking about costs and income, one of the reasons why the council is looking as though it may be able to balance its budget this year is because of the Clean Air Zone. And in the budget consultation, there's an indication that there are quite a few millions of pounds coming in as a result of the Clean Air Zone. But we've been asking questions as councillors all this year, and we still do not know what that income figure is. And we're promised that there might be a report sometime in December, but whether it'll be made public and we'll be allowed to see it, we don't know.
Now, might some of this change under the committee system starting in May next year? Is this just a decision of the mayor's office? Mayor Marvin Rees and Kevin Slocum, the people in there, are deciding, well, we're not going to let anyone know about this?
It would appear that might be the case.
I mean, how can you scrutinise a budget if you're not being told figures of income?
You should be sat on our resources scrutiny committee, because that's exactly what we've said. We actually said, how can you be planning ahead? How can you be producing a plan if you aren't actually telling us what the key figures are?
What I'd be thinking next is, can you do a Freedom of Information request? A public body, they should maybe respond to that. But that seems to be a bit silly for a councillor to have to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So at the moment, we only know what you and everybody can find out by completing the consultation document on next year's budget and adding up the figures in there and seeing how much they're telling us is coming from the Clean Air Zone. But we don't know any more than that.
So there's also, I know the council have been blocking information about the number of, for example, just simply number of fines, numbers of successful appeals mm-hmm. against fines, this information. So why is it, do you think, this Clean Air Zone, there's so much secrecy surrounding it? I mean, almost like it's a commercial company running it.
I have absolutely no idea. I thought part of the strategy of it was to encourage people to improve the emissions from their vehicles And therefore, I would have thought publicising the clean air zone on a regular basis and how much income it's generating might be a very good way of encouraging people to do that. So I can't begin to see, unless it's embarrassment, I can't begin to see why it's not being shared with us at an earlier stage.
Now, I just today got through my door something to do. It's called a consultation over the council tax relief. So can you explain a little bit about that? We've got something called council tax. It was introduced in the Thatcher era.
Right.
People with no incomes generally don't pay it, and yet they're thinking now that these are people are going to be not going to be relieved from paying it, and they're going to have to stop. Can you just take us through that?
Yeah. So Bristol introduced a council tax reduction scheme, I think it's about 11 years ago now, and the council tax reduction scheme pays a contribution to council tax for those on the lowest income levels in the city who otherwise would be paying council tax. So at the moment, some 23,000 residents benefit from the council tax reduction scheme. In the budget that went through in February this year, Mayor Rees proposed that scheme should be, the funding of it should be reduced by £3 million. Now, at the moment, the council tax reduction scheme costs, I think, is about £43 million. So he's proposed it's reduced by £3 million. However, the problem is that £3 million is coming from people who are going to struggle to afford it. So
let's be frank, many of those people have got no income at all.
Many of them do have income. So it's if they have no income, they probably...
They're on benefits.
They're on benefits. Yeah. So the council tax reduction scheme particularly is those who are in work but do not earn enough to actually live to pay their rates and their rent and their council tax. So, but because of this, it means that in order to raise £3 million from the council tax, they'll have to collect £6 million because it'll cost them £1 million to collect it, and probably £2 million of it, they estimate, won't be paid. So they need to target £6 million to collect £3 million. So there is a lot of argument about whether, in fact, it will produce even that. There's no evidence to prove one way or the other because most people in this situation haven't paid council tax for 11 years.
So, are there any other cities we can compare this with?
There's mixed information out there. Most of the big cities don't have a scheme that's as generous as Bristol's anyway. They've reduced it years ago.
Right. But anyway, Martin, can I just bring you on this? Sorry, Jeff. But yeah. Martin, spending £6 million to raise £3 million off of people on very low incomes.
Well, I've got I'll express an interest here. I'm one of the people that is in benefit receives this benefit. I'm in work, but my wages don't cover. So I benefit from this. As I understood it, Jeff, they were going to abolish it completely, but that's not what you're saying.
No.
So they're going to reduce it by £3 million. From £43 million spend. Is that per year, presumably?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, it's. I mean, in terms of saving money, it's not really much money to save, is it? Let's face it. Especially if you put people who are on low incomes into the council tax collection system. And I used to work for Bristol Debt Advice Centre years ago. Mm-hmm. These people... I've got very low incomes, one way or the other. Either they're on benefits, disabled, or they're in work, but in low wages. The getting the money out of those kind of people is really difficult. You know, it's virtually impossible to collect. So, in other words, you spend an awful lot of money, chasing people, taking them to court, for example, with all the court fees and everything.
Yep.
And then when you get the money off them, it's not even a lot of money that you're going to get off them, because they're all in the lower band and all the rest of it, they're not actually paying that much anyway.
Absolutely.
So I find it incredible that they would think of doing that. If they were going to say, like, we're going to do like others, I think it was always the local decision, wasn't it, whether to have council tax benefit or not. Yep. Some parts of the country, they didn't bring it in at all. People just had to pay what they owed, and that was that. And then in other places, they decided that they were going to defray it. I mean, we can come on later on possibly to a discussion about whether we should have a council tax at all, which is a big issue. But I mean, we have got one.
Yep.
And then when we got one, I mean, when I was working for Bristol Dead Advice Centre, I was talking to the people who collect the council tax in the council. This is over a decade ago now. And I was saying, what we need to do is people who haven't paid by a certain date in the year, they are your targets for people who need debt advice. Mm-hmm. So what we could be doing is using this as a trigger mechanism to see these, to proactively go out and find the people who haven't paid and give them free debt advice. Because usually if they haven't paid their council tax, it's because they've not paid in lots of other bills.
Yep.
But anyway, the Blairite managers at the Bristol Dead Advice Centre didn't like that at all, and I ended up losing my job. But there you are. That was then. This is now.
I mean, this £2,000 or whatever people are going to have to pay that they didn't have to before in council tax for the low income people is a massive slice of the disposable income. In fact, it might even be larger than their annual disposable income. A lot of people just don't have hardly anything. They're paying so much out in electricity and rent, especially with the cost of living crisis. Anyway, Joe, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I was just going to make the point that Bristol City Council is already really struggling to get council tax from people. Mm-hmm. That's gone up. It's the total council tax debt owed to the council has more than tripled since 2018, from a recent Bristol Cable article. So it's gone up from 15.8 million to 51.1 million since 2018. That's partly because of COVID, I think, but it's people already really struggling to pay that money, and the methods that are in place to extract that money are not up to it.
I suppose, Jeff, there's a balance here between some people who can't pay and some that won't pay.
That's always that is always going to be the challenge. But the very difficult thing with this whole process, as a Conservative, the thing I find surprising is that the proposal to do this came from a Labour mayor. But the Conservative Party view is that we think everybody should be paying something in council tax, because that is part of their ability to contribute and comment on the service that they receive.
Okay, look, well, I'm not so sure. Okay,
but what we also recognise is exactly the point that's made about people have to be able to afford it. It has to be collectible. And somewhere in this, it's surprising that the council isn't acknowledging that Bristol has the highest rental payments outside of London. So it's not surprising that we have people with this significant financial difficulties. And so even in that situation, we had the mayor proposed this. Labour councillors and Green councillors have voted in support of the budget, which included this recommendation. So as a result, it came in there is a way of balancing the books.
Are they just desperate to get income at the moment? Is that where this is coming from?
They're desperate to have a balanced budget, because by law they have to have a balanced budget. They want to produce a budget that where the income and expenditure are equal when the mayor hands it over to the committee system. I don't believe they're that worried whether that income comes in and whether that expenditure budget is accurate, but they have to have something that appears as though it is.
They've got to have a piece of paper. Martin, really, the seeds of this were sown in the 1980s, weren't they, with getting rid of the rates and introducing this council tax on per head of population rather than on people who own the property.
Can I just clarify, did the Conservatives vote against this? Or did you abstain?
I believe we voted against the budget, not specifically on this.
It
was the whole budget.
The whole budget,
because the way council works, why give people a choice on individual issues when
you can lump it all together?
So
you voted against the budget because you're the opposition, so you voted against the budget.
And bear in mind, all councillors were basically briefed that if they didn't allow a budget to go through, they could be surcharged and made to make up the shortfall, which may have concentrated the minds of some councillors. But
I think we need a debtor's prison in Bristol, a brand new one to be built, not only for the poorest citizens, but also for councillors.
It could well be.
How's it been, by the way? I mean, you've lived through all of this process of going over to the mayor system, now coming and turning back. How have things changed for you as a councillor and your input that you're able to have sitting around the table making decisions?
Well, I've always been in a party that's been either the second or third party and therefore not in control of the council. So I've always had to resort on being able to argue my case for things I think and put it forward and try and convince people to at least bear in mind what I'm saying. I supported the idea of a mayor because I believed Bristol needed strong, firm leadership. I'm not commenting on either Marvin or George's individuals, but what I've seen is the amount of power it gives to one person is something I wouldn't want one of my best friends to have that level of power. I don't think it's appropriate. There's no check or balance, and therefore that is why I believe we had to change from a mayoral system to something that spread the decision-making more equitably and meant that there was an ability for a check and
so
a balance.
So how does the decision-making change? Because we're as of next May, we're going to have a council leader. It'll probably be a Green council leader Greens are the largest party.
You're going to have a council leader, but the decisions are going to be taken in eight committees. And those committees, you'll have a chairman who will have some of the responsibilities that go with go at the moment with a cabinet member, but the decisions will be taken by the members of that committee voting. So there is no guarantee at the moment. If something's on a cabinet agenda, you know that's going to be approved because the cabinet members put it on the agenda and the cabinet member's the one who turns up and makes the decision at the cabinet meeting, and it doesn't matter what anybody says. Under the committee system, that decision is going to be taken in committee, and therefore there will be an opportunity if there is any feeling of manipulation or concealment or misinformation, there will be an ability for the members of that committee to express their concern and vote against it.
Perish the thought, Bristol, that anyone would wish to conceal anything from either you or the public.
I was not implying that that goes on, of course, but there is inevitably in a situation where councillors in charge and officers put forward papers that members, even of their own party, may on occasion want a little more information to help them form an opinion. And I believe this now makes that more likely in the future.
So are there any councillors that they get a chunk of papers for one of these committee meetings, they don't really read through it, they just want to nod everything through to get to the sandwiches?
No sandwiches. No sandwiches. No.
Why not? That's terrible.
No, they got cut years ago.
Haven't you got a subsidised canteen? No?
I haven't found it. No. That was one of the cuts of many years ago. The biscuits and the sandwiches went. That stopped. Members will have to take an interest and read the papers. At the moment, you have a cabinet member, but take Helen Holland, cabinet member dealing with adult social care. Helen has that brief. She makes the decisions, but she also puts an enormous amount of time and effort in developing that service and ensuring that it's managed properly. But she is the only one who makes decisions. There is a scrutiny commission that will ask some questions, but under the new system, the committee will be the one making the decisions. So therefore, my hope, and I hope this isn't naive, it'll be more open and transparent.
So, okay, so once we have a largest party next year, probably the Greens, what's the makeup of the committees? Does that mean the Greens chair them all?
The makeup of the committees is proportionate to the makeup of council. So if any one party has more than half the councillors, they will have more than half the councillors on each of the committees. But if no party has an overall majority, then the decisions in those committees will depend on how the councillors choose to vote. The chairs of each of the committees and the chair and the leader and deputy leader of council are chosen by full council. So, again, that will be open to how people choose who they think is going to be the right person for the job.
Now, you've been a councillor how long?
Too long, some would say. About 22 years.
Why do you do it? It must be quite frustrating being constantly... I mean, Conservatives are never going to be the leading group on Bristol City Council, are they? So you're constantly in opposition.
Well, yes, opposition in the technical political term, but actually one of the things I really hope comes out of the committee system is a recognition that actually there's a lot more each of the parties have in common than they differ over, and this should be more about identifying the common themes and common priorities than it should be about political point scoring and airing differences at every given opportunity. And what keeps me doing it is the continued hope that one can make a better decision than it would have been made if I hadn't been there to influence it or comment on it. I think that's probably true of almost all councillors.
You do get paid as well, though, don't you?
We do, yep.
Yes. And I think if you're in the cabinet, you get a little stipend or maybe a few thousand pounds extra.
Quite a lot extra.
Yeah, this is a system of patronage, really, isn't it? So the mayor can say the four or five or maybe six or seven people.
Nine,
okay.
people. Yeah, keep count.
Keep going. Yeah. So the nine people who I find most loyal to me, I can just pay them extra.
Indeed, or it could be the ones who are most disloyal could be paid extra to. I mean, one way or the other, it could do. Whereas, and that is the system. The mayor can actually determine who he wants in his cabinet, whereas the committee chairs will be determined by a vote of full council. It may be the party whips will identify who their nominees are for that role, but council might choose not to vote for them.
So which is the best system, do you think? Because it's a lot more work, actually, to get all of these committees even in place under the committee system. A mayor is much simpler.
It's simpler, but the biggest flaw is that only the cabinet member knows the full detail of their brief. So you don't actually have any succession building up within the council, so that if that person resigns, walks away, whatever happens, or gets sacked, there isn't necessarily someone who's fully up to speed. So what that does is puts much more power in the hands of council officers, because they're dealing with a newcomer who may not be fully aware of all the issues involving a decision. It could take several years for someone to get up to speed on that.
Bristol's mayor this week has warned councils couldn't end up providing only social care and children's services. Bristol City Council's facing £32 million funding black hole, that's what you were talking about earlier, over the next few years. So the mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, has warned that councils could end up providing only social care and children's services. Since 2010, councils in England have received less money from the government while also facing rising demand for services. Now, look, hidden in that question is this is the Conservative central government's fault. Ever since 2010, the coalition government was elected with Clegg and Cameron, the bit by bit, the amount of money central government are giving to local authorities has been falling. Yep. And yet, demand on services is increasing. So it almost seems to me as if local government is, you know, you just go a certain period down the line, local government will be history. If you haven't got a budget, there's no point in you even sitting there.
I don't disagree with you. There is a need for proper funding. There is also, however, a concern if one looks at some of the funding, and I can give you examples both in terms of the special needs budget and in terms of adult care, where the amount of spending in Bristol has not been spent wisely or effectively and is therefore costing far more than it would do in comparator authorities. And there, you know, Bristol's, and over the whole of the time I've been on council, Bristol's had issues. One of the proposals in the budget consultation document, they're not consulting on it, but they've outlined the proposal, is that people when they're discharged from hospital should have a quicker review of their care package to see if they can save costs by reducing the care package if someone's condition improves. Now, that's pretty sensible stuff. But if you went back to about 2003 or 2004, when there was a social services crisis at the city council, experts came in and produced a report telling them that's what they should do. And here we are, 16 years on, they're still suggesting that's what they should do. And yet, had that been implemented properly, many millions of pounds could have been saved. So I don't disagree with you that we need more and consistent funding, but I would also argue that there are very significant extravagances, both in terms of those services and, yeah, I know I could start a whole new discussion about either Bristol Energy or the Bristol Beacon, but if one looks at the huge amounts of money that were squandered on both of those, then, you know, you can see that Bristol could actually have done things differently and better.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about those, because you've seen them right through. I'm sure you were involved in the scrutiny process.
Yep.
I mean, what you're doing, scrutinising this stuff, is surely saying, hang on, guys, watch out, there's too much money being spent here.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do that? The total is how much? We're talking about...
Well, on the Beacon?
Between both of them.
Oh, well, energy company, I think, was something like £30 to £40 million. The Bristol Beacon is an extra £60 million.
Right, so this is 100 million, which... What?
17 million, I guess.
I think it might be, yeah.
10 to 80. 10,
yeah.
It was originally 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've gone to about 80.
Yeah,
so change. We're talking about ballpark figures, around about 100 million pounds has been, well, just poured down the drain, effectively. Mm-hmm. So why didn't people like you, scrutinising it, make sure that that didn't happen?
Because we were not told what was happening. So I can give you some very clear examples on the Beacon. We were asking questions because we did not believe the spending figures that we were being told, and eventually got the admission that the original plan was wrong.
So this is the old Colston Hall, for people that don't know, yeah?
Yeah, so this what was the Colston Hall?
Which is
Hall?
Kind of complex, really, in the city centre. Yeah.
And so we got this report that told us all the reasons why it was wrong. And by that point in the process, we were given the option. We weren't given the option, but we were told the Cabinet had the option. One was to say, we won't finish it. And that would have involved a cost of almost the same as the cost is anyway, because they would have had to repay grants to the Arts Council because they wouldn't have finished the project. Or they spent the money and finished the project. So we didn't have any. There was nothing we could scrutinise in that sense. But the bit that I have failed to get an explanation on is they're claiming the reason for the costs is a series of things that they didn't know. But all the things they didn't know, including hollow pillars and water running underneath the stream running underneath the base of the hall, was in a report that was presented to George Ferguson's cabinet, and we were aware of it. But of course, all the officers who were involved in that process have been retired or left the organisation.
Actually, yes, Marvin Rees brought in a whole new tranche of officers, didn't he?
Exactly. So there's no corporate history. No one knew, and no one talked to me, because I was a villain of the piece, because I was in the previous cabinet, so I wasn't going to be listened to. And no one talked and sounded it out. And on top of that, what they also did was they took the roof off the building and left it totally open to the elements before they did the survey to discover it was going to cost them £50 million more to finish it off. And anybody who's ever dealt with a property would actually do a survey before they bought the property, certainly before they took a roof off it to see what needed doing.
Now, so if I was an unkind person, Martin, I could talk about fraud in these contracts, couldn't I? Some of these developers, the people who are actually doing these changes, they do know how to bump a budget up, don't they?
Well, that's true, but obviously I don't have the level of detail that Jeff has got. I mean, as I understand it, the Colston Hall did belong to the council, didn't it? It was a council building.
Yeah.
And I used to work for the council in the social...
And it still is.
Social economy. No, it's not.
No, it is.
Yeah, it still belongs to the council.
So it belongs to the council, but what they did, before they did all the development, they agreed to let it to the music trust that runs the Beacon on a peppercorn rent. So because it's on a peppercorn rent, the council has to write off every penny it spends on the Colston Hall when it spends it, because it's no value to its asset because of the peppercorn rent.
Well, I mean, this is a kind of normal thing. Sorry, Martin. This is a kind of normal thing, isn't it? This is what councils do. They run things that wouldn't actually be commercially viable in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And this is why we pay our taxes, because we know that there are certain things we want to happen in the city that a commercial sector will never deliver. Yeah. Isn't that right?
Oh, that's absolutely. But you still have to have some commercial responsibility in how you run it and how you operate it.
Isn't a big thing with what's happened with the Bristol Beacon the nature of the contract that was done with the contractor, and so that all the risk is on the council, all these things they find, all things that go wrong. Every point requires a negotiation between the contractor and the council. So you've just got this very uneven relationship where the contractor is, they're going to have the best people, legal people.
Yeah, what you're saying is
and they're going to argue every single point, and all the risk in that contract is on the council.
Well, the contractor is constantly threatening
if anything goes wrong
to drop you in it.
Yeah, and I think what happened is the contractor saw how complex the issues were, and actually said, well, either we've got to do an exercise to fully cost out every aspect of this, or you've got to take the risk. And certainly, not on this issue, but on many such issues, when you come up with things like this, you mentioned fraud. To be honest, in my view, it is more likely that it's because the council was not able to manage the contract. And most or all of the officers who were involved in the initial contract for the Bristol Beacon were not there to see it through. And it was only the incoming group of new officers who then started to analyse and interpret. I think with the best, putting the best judgments on it, I think they desperately wanted to succeed, and they wanted to have a proper concert hall for Bristol. But they then went ahead and ended up with contracts that the council had to see through, but at enormous cost.
One thing I must ask you about is the arena. I mean, this has been going on ever since I was on the Cultural Development Partnership years ago. Before that, the arena was supposed to be built at Temple Mead. Mm-hmm. No, then that money was handed over to the land. Freudian slip, folks. That land was handed over to the university, obviously worth a lot of money, right next to Temple Meads. Then the idea idea is, oh, we're going to build it up at Filton. Still, I mean, last time I was driving past here, I stopped the car, went to the old the chain link fence that used to be around Filton Airfield, looked through, still doesn't seem to be anything happening.
We're told it's progressing forward. So is someone who was involved in the original Temple Island site for the arena. I can see there were potential problems with the size or an access for the sort of Arctics bringing in all the equipment and what have you. I can see there were challenges there, but the bit that made sense to me was that it happened to be really quite close to a railway station that actually was an intercity railway station. And again, this is another question that I've asked repeatedly but can't get answers to. I do not understand how having it next to a railway station with, it's either a 3 or 4 carriage length platform with one train capable of running in each direction at any one time. I'm not sure how many days it's going to take to actually get the number of people in the arena out of the arena if they rely on train. So, and in this day and age, cutting down on the amount of individual traffic going to an arena ought to have been the key. And I fear what that's going to do if the arena goes ahead in terms of the North Bristol and the North Bristol fringe in terms of pollution, congestion, and just too much traffic.
Do we really need an arena in the city? I mean, this is a sort of thing that I suppose you get in places like LA or, you know, maybe Wembley Arena, something like that. Cardiff, yeah, true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I show my age. I'm at the stage where the thought of actually going to London or Cardiff or Birmingham to see someone perform actually is a lot of hard work. I'd love to think we had that facility in Bristol. But whether it's in the right place, and you know, there's a lot of money being spent, public money being spent, on the infrastructure, which will improve the value of YTL's site in Patchway and Cribbs Causeway and Filton, that I think could have. They should have been funding themselves rather than relying on the council and WECA to fund.
I suppose I must also mention something about the clean air zone again before we finish, because there was an excellent article, I thought anyway, in the Daily Telegraph this week. Talking about the London ULEZ ultra low emission zone. I think there's quite a lot of people out there who are not convinced this is really about clean air, particularly when you have to, here in Bristol and in London, quite often travel a great big long journey around to get round the zone, so you don't have to pay the money. Mm-hmm. And of course, maybe emitting twice or three times the amount mm-hmm. of emissions that you would do. So I don't understand how that helps the air to be clean. In fact, it doesn't, does it? But the figures that they come out with in London are, a lot more than here, quite obviously. The organisation's latest accounts show that it spent $8.5 billion on an income of $5.8 billion, leaving a $2.7 billion hole, around about £300 for every single Londoner. Those struggling to bear the daily £12.50 cost to go to work, for example, of Sadiq Khan's ultra-low emission zone should also sleep easier, knowing their sacrifice is ensuring the skiing holidays and private school fees of the 766 Transport for London staff who took over annual remuneration over £100,000. The point here, again, it's a bit like our council tax in London, our council tax here in Bristol. The ULEZ in London, they're spending far more in their terms. It's billions, not millions, but billions in implementing this new charge than they're actually getting in revenue.
Well, certainly in the original proposals for the clean air zone in Bristol, one of the biggest expenses was actually dismantling it again after 3 or 4 years, because they believed at that point it would no longer be necessary. I don't know how the costs for installation have gone compared to what was budgeted, but certainly the figures that we saw originally were not on the scale of London. It was not a massive spend, but of course that was being encouraged and supported by Department for Transport, who wanted it there because of the clean air issues in Bristol.
One of the things which wasn't in the King's speech this week was adult social care. What a lot of people are looking at this is a complete disaster right across the country, with people losing homes, finding, for example, that the local authority are not paying for what they're supposed to be paying for in terms of particularly looking after the elderly, Alzheimer's patients, people like that. What's your view of this is a national issue, really. Mm-hmm. What's been going on? You mentioned, I think, was Helen Holland who was responsible for that. Yep. What's been going wrong with this, and what should the central government be doing about it? I realise it's not your call, but you're in the Conservative Party.
It's not my call, but what I will tell you what's happening now is that they have formed what's called an integrated care board, which is a massive step forward, because what we've had until that came into place in the last year or so was that the local authorities were managing their part of the social care budget and the health service was managing its part of the social care budget, and they both employed teams of people whose main job was to argue with the other. So hospitals were keen to discharge people often earlier than they might have been ready to be discharged, so that they were moving the cost over to the local authority. Local authority was trying to resist taking responsibility until long after they should have been discharged. If you actually run that as a joint operation, you have the ability to manage the budget and actually only have one person looking after the patient, rather than employing two people to haggle over when the patient's sort of costs should become someone else's responsibility. So I think that's a classic example of where better management, more focused on the well-being of the individual who's being looked after, potentially could save costs and produce a better outcome.
Yeah, but is anything going to happen? This is the thing. We've got the last year of this Conservative government almost certainly out on their ear this time next year. I think most polls are suggesting that, not just here in, not talking about the local election, I'm talking about the general election this time next year. So it seems to me it's just another fudge at national government level.
I think it's fair to say it is such a big problem that no one can come up with what is a workable solution.
Martin, any thoughts?
What we're talking about here is basically public money, whether it's channeled through the health service or through local authorities. That's what we're talking about. How are you going to fund that? Well, of course, there is the question of, the so-called death taxes and taxes on mortgages. And you know, because in Scotland, people still can get free care if they've got dementia and they don't have to sell their houses. Whereas in Britain, in England, you do. Yep. So there's a big, everything's turned into a sort of a bit of a dog's breakfast in terms of what's happening. I would argue that social care is so important, and it's so unfair, because if you get dementia, you don't get half. If you got cancer, you will get support from the health service. You will be supported. Say you get leukemia, could cost up to £1 million to treat you. The money will be
there.
You may not
get treated, though. You may go on a waiting list.
All right, but the point is, at least in principle, you will be looked after, and it'll come out of general taxation. I think local authorities, I think it should just be an NHS. If it was up to me, I'd just make it an NHS responsibility across the board, central government money, so you don't get postcode lotteries. And, of course, you've just got one chain of command. I mean, it's obviously better to have them having a joint committee, but there's still going to be pressure because the local authority is going to be trying to save their money and the managers in the health service are going to be trying to save their money. So there'll still be tension there, even if they're all on the same committee. And I'm not saying it's easy for me to say that, cut the Gordian knot and have it all funded by central government. I know there's all sorts of reasons why that can't happen, but ideally that's what should happen in my view.
But I don't think I disagree with that in the sense that local authority budgets can be funded to provide basic services for all, and that can work. But for example, if you take the special needs individuals, some of the child special needs support cases, there can be £1 million a year of cost for one individual. Now, of course, that individual needs that support, and it should be given. But if you end up with a family moving across a boundary, and I've certainly heard of cases where a family with two special needs children moves across a boundary, and a council's budget goes up by £2 million a year simply because of that. And council budgets are not big enough to manage those sort of changes. So therefore, dealing with the exceptions out of a central budget makes sense, and then you can actually be providing the basic support at a local level.
We're going to move on to talk about the King's Speech a bit, because this is the announcement of the announcement of the legislative programmes. Very unexciting, although I thought King Charles put a little bit more gusto into it than he did last year. He seemed to be sort of almost like he was having a bad day last year when he read out the Queen's Speech for his mum whilst she was still alive. A little bit more gusto in this, lots about things like climate change. He did say, Jeff, though, that they were going to be doing everything they could to address the cost of living crisis. Now, you, as a money man, how would you do that? Because it's a bit of some would say intractable, but we've got to put more money in people's pockets. We've got to find some way of either bringing down rents or and mortgage rates or increasing people's income. We've got to find some way of doing that. We have to.
Yeah. I mean, clearly inflation, in my view, needs managing and controlling, because it actually affects everybody.
Well, it's being managed upwards. For the last couple of years, it's been managed upwards.
I don't know. I quite agree with that, but in a sense, it's certainly governments often need a bit of inflation, because it's one way of reducing the amount of money that they've got to repay, if you like.
If interest rates go up, doesn't that mean the government has to pay more money on all of its loans? Yeah,
and for me, I think that the Bank of England is misunderstanding the economic figures, or understanding the way mortgages now operate. My very simplistic feeling is that they still think that everybody is on a variable mortgage as they were probably 30 years ago. And I don't think they understand that a large number of people haven't felt the impact of the interest rate increases
because
they're fixed. Yeah. And
but those fixed rates get reviewed, don't they, every once in a while?
They do, when you come to the end of a term. So there are people, but I only know from talking with family members that they know something nasty is going to happen when their mortgage rate gets reviewed, but they're carrying on with their spending at the moment as if because it hasn't happened yet. And they keep hoping what they read in the papers about interest rates falling in the near future is true. And I think the Bank of England has misunderstood that impact, and I fear that might actually cause the slowdown which the economic figures out today is suggesting could be the case, because we seem to have plateaued.
Yeah, well, Martin, what they're saying actually is that there is a serious problems with the economy, and we're now in a recession. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think I agree with what Jeff's saying there. I think the Bank of England, if you look at the Monetary Policy Committee, there are hawks and doves on the Monetary Policy Committee, and I would definitely been a dove, because you can overkill with this. You've got to raise interest rates to stabilise things. If you don't do that, it causes problems. But if you overdo that because you've misunderstood the way the market works, as you were suggesting, and also, of course, you know, I would have been one of those voting not to increase. And, of course, they've stopped increasing now, so they've stabilised it. The fundamentals, though, is that what we're talking about here is managing the patient on life support, if you like. You know, it's a question of what we're going to do. If I were you, we wouldn't start from here. We've actually had decades of mismanagement, frankly. And that's why, I mean, why are we so dependent upon property prices in this country?
You're saying there's no quick fix. I mean, looking at the, I don't know if you were watching ITV News yesterday evening, was a particularly shocking news at 10. We've been treated like criminals, families left desperate and homeless as no-fault evictions soar. Now, due to some of the tax changes, many people who are buy-to-let landlords are now finding it impossible to actually make money out of their places, so they're having to sell them. That means evict people. So this is... I think is it Daniel Hewitt, ITV's housing guy. It's the highest level in 7 years. Ministry of Justice data shows the number of Section 21 eviction claims has jumped by nearly 40% just in the space of a year. So a lot of people just basically being kicked out on the streets. And like this lady says, she was in tears on the telly last night. We've been treated like criminals. Now, this is no way to run a country, is it?
I think that is if you like, an unintended consequence. What we've actually got is, as far as landlords are concerned, you've got the fact that the government has removed some of the more generous tax benefits of a landlord over the last 6 or 7 years. And what you've also got is that serial landlords have been mortgaging and borrowing huge amounts of money to finance their portfolios, and were able to do so because interest rates were so low.
Yeah.
Now,
so is it an unintended consequence of putting interest rates up? Because surely that's obvious. That's going to this sort of thing's going to happen. Also, as the property prices go up in value, so yeah, they're hitting other.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's unintended. In the Bank of England putting interest rates up wasn't doing this to get people evicted from properties. It was doing it to control inflation. But because there has been unfettered lending for these serial buy-to-let entrepreneurs who've been massively overborrowed, they're now in trouble, and that's why it's unintended. Doesn't make it any easier for the individuals, and I don't fully understand why they can't actually sell the property with a tenant in there, because that would suit everybody's needs, because it's housing stock, it's still there. And
you
it's
won't
still
get so much for the house if you're selling it. I mean, it's vacant possession. That's what people want, to buy a house with nobody in there. They don't want someone in there. And increasingly we're finding property that's not being used, that's just being used as an investment. You know, there's nobody in, whether it's a commercial property, land, or housing, someone can just buy that and keep it empty so they can sell it whenever they want to.
Yeah, that doesn't compute as far as I'm concerned. I can't understand why anybody would do that, but they do. Although in Bristol they have changed the rules so that the level of council tax will go up if a property is left empty.
So good.
That will gradually, or should gradually, encourage those who are doing that.
I mean, it doesn't seem like we're progressing as a nation. We seem to be going backwards. This is the sort of thing that's happening, people being evicted. Anyway, I'll put a link to that report on ITV, which I thought was excellent last night, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Just a couple of stories before you go, Jeff. One is, we've got to have a listen to King Charles now.
A bill will be introduced to deal with the scourge of unlicensed pedicabs in London. My government is committed to tackling anti-Semitism and ensuring that the Holocaust is never forgotten. A bill will progress the construction of a National Holocaust Memorial and Learning Centre in Victoria Tower Gardens. My government will act to keep communities safe from crime, antisocial behaviour, terrorism and illegal migration.
So that's just a little excerpt from it. This whole business of anti-Semitism doesn't seem to want to go away. First of all, we were hearing about it in the Labour Party, and now there's a scourge of anti-Semitism that King Charles is talking about. I'm not quite sure where that's going on, and it might possibly be because people are looking at what's happening in Gaza and saying, well, hang on, this isn't right. You know, anyway, whether they're motivated by, you know, the same motivations that led to the Holocaust, I think, is extremely questionable. But the main point here is, what do you make of what's been going on with the use of anti-Semitism? Do you think it's been justified using it to, you know, remove people from politics? We've had several councillors that you've worked with over the years who've been removed from parties because they're supposedly anti-Semitic by a kind of quasi-judicial process.
Oh, that's a huge issue to throw in at this stage. I think I'd turn it right another way and just talk about what my view is, and I have an inclusive view, and that view is that I mean, our city is made up of people of all sorts of faiths and all sorts of beliefs, and to be honest, every one of them's got a right to have an opinion, and some of those might have an opinion that isn't very kind or charitable to one of the other groups. But with, if I go back to an example, the citizenship ceremony that happens regularly in Bristol, one of the points that's made at that is that in this country we have a freedom of speech to say anything, but with that freedom goes a responsibility to actually consider the impact of what you're saying on the people you're talking about. And therefore, I would condemn anti-Semitism, but I would condemn any form of Islamophobia as well. I believe we've got to value everybody and treat them as individuals. So I think that is an issue, but it is, to me, it's worrying that social media creates the opportunity for people to foment some really quite harsh and unpleasant views on all manner of faiths, religions, and different groups of people. And I don't feel comfortable with the level of strength of views that's being expressed.
What do you make of, I've just brought it up on the screen here, it's almost like Bristol's Private Eye. Some people think it's a really scurrilous magazine, but they're extremely rude about all sorts of people of all political stripes, the Bristolian. Yep. Have you got a subscription to it? Do you take it regularly? Because we have all sorts of scandals. In fact, in the latest edition, we've got Joe has been mentioned. Do you want to just say a little bit about that, Joe, that article?
Oh, well, this is referring to... I was writing an article for the Bristol Cable about a development of three office blocks at St Mary Le Port. And about... basically, there was a community group, Friends of Castle Park, who were very... were at the forefront of what the developer was saying was their community engagement. Basically, the piece was about the fact that this community group wasn't a bona fide community group. It had never had any meetings, you know, no offices, AGM or anything, but it was just a Facebook group. Mm. And the person who'd set the Facebook group up had set themselves up as a representative of the group without any kind of democratic mandate, you know, or voting on anything. And I was doing this piece and had contacted this guy, and then I was told by the editor that a complaint had been made that I was harassing this person, and I asked who was that, and it turned out it was Nicola Beach, Councillor Nicola Beach, who's in Marvin Rees's cabinet. So it was that story, basically.
Okay.
Who I was told had made this claim of harassment against me to a director of the Bristol Cable, who I think is the partner of Tom Renard, who's another Labour cabinet member.
Oh, this is so insidious, isn't it? It's such a pity when we've got media who have got kind of financial interests in the city. I mean, there's also, of course, Bristol 24/7. It's got Marty Burgess as one of the, who's a merchant venturer and one of the directors of the Lakota. So it's very difficult for Bristol 24/7 to be writing about. So what do you think generally, Jeff, about the state of our media? I mean, we are all quite fans of the Bristolian here. And even though they come out with extremely rude, I won't read this, a bent piece of lying bleep, which is one of the latest articles about Bristol City Council's new planning boss, Simone the Concrete Queen Wilding. So what do you make about the state of someone who's actually there at the sharp end in those meetings, deciding on what happens with all that, whatever it is, £350 million a year of our public money, probably more by now, maybe less, I'm not sure, as how the press reflects what's going on?
Well, so to me, not just because Joe sat next to me, but to me, the independent media probing and asking questions is absolutely essential. It's a key part of our democracy, to be honest. Perhaps it shouldn't be, because it shouldn't be necessary, but it is necessary, and it's right that questions are asked, and preferably that answers are given. Part of the frustration I have is that often councillors in cabinet and council officers don't understand that if they present things in a certain way or only provide certain bits of information, it creates a suspicion that something isn't right, and that we as councillors ask the questions and we're assured that everything's fine.
I think there's almost something medieval about when there's a pronouncement by a public official, then they expect that it will be taken at face value. I mean, you know, surely someone like you, you know, you must be used to taking a bit of criticism on the chin, and that's surely what's necessary in that role.
I'll be honest, there are times when the articles I have read in the Bristolian are a little hard-hitting and close to the knuckle, I think it's fair to say. But, to be honest, I certainly in my days in the cabinet, I did get the odd mention. I think one of them might even have been complimentary, but that's
really shocking.
It wasn't offensive then.
Must have been a typo. Probably.
But actually, I think it's a really important role, I think we need these things brought out. You know, if we go back to the issue that happened a few years ago when the council started looking into the social media accounts of special needs parents who were objecting to the way it conducted its affairs. And that was outrageous. The council actually called for an independent inquiry into it, and the mayor refused to allow it to happen. And we couldn't do any more to pursue it. But it's totally wrong that if things like that are going on that are inappropriate or unacceptable, they have to be investigated, and the media, the independent media in particular, are tenacious enough to keep on persevering. And there will be councillors that will work with them and help them to know the areas to probe and ask more questions.
Well, at which point I must put out a little appeal, because we're trying to raise a little bit of money right now for this studio that we're sitting in, because the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, there are threats to bump them up to a much higher business rate, even though it's actually not a business here. And so they're looking to try and get a little bit of income. So if anyone would like to just donate, maybe subscribe, even if it's just a fiver a month or something, to help the show carry on, you can do that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. There's a little donate button where you can just do a little subscription. Or else, if you don't want to go through PayPal, you can just contact me directly via all sorts of ways on that show page and set up a little standing order. But obviously, it's only if you can afford to do so. But, you know, this is where we are now. A lot of this mass media, the mainstream media that's got the resources to do these investigations, simply isn't doing it, because the people who are subject to those investigations seem to be able to swing it with the management, not necessarily the editors, but the management, to dissuade them. Thankfully, we do have these local democracy reporters, don't we, Jeff?
Yeah.
They do a pretty good job, and the commercial media would probably never do what Alex...
They do a fantastic job. But just to put it in perspective as well, and I'm not sure how long I've been coming in and joining you, Tony, and on the show from time to time, and there are occasions when I think some of your theories and comments might... don't necessarily fit in with my political take on things.
Well, you're much more polite than George Ferguson. He used to say, it's conspiracy Tony again.
But the fact is that if there are things that suggest there might be a conspiracy, we need people to ask the questions.
Yeah.
When I've been doing this in the City Council, I'm often told that it's down to ineptitude rather than conspiracy. And I must admit, the more I see of the City Council, the more I'm convinced that could well be the case, but the questions need to be asked. So my view is that I support people asking questions, even if I don't agree with their agenda, because it's important that if we're open and transparent, we've got to have the ability for people to ask questions and for them to be answered properly, so that one can get a clear handle on what's going on.
Well, I think that's absolutely appalling. You've given me such a pat on the back there, Jeff. absolutely disgusting. Also, our final piece is going to be looking at tomorrow, because it's a big day tomorrow. I've never known, in all my years of journalism since, the late 1980s, of a march in London that's got so much pre-publicity. Ever since last weekend, we've had news stories on all channels talking about a massive march going on tomorrow in London in support of Gaza. Normally, these big marches don't get any pre-publicity, the idea being to sort of stop people. And in fact, whilst the march is going on, often there is a publicity blackout so that people don't decide to hop on the train and go and join a march, that sort of thing. But this one is completely different. And there's been a lot of talk about the far right turning up in London to potentially clash with the pro-Palestinian demonstrators, which it looks as if it's going to be an enormous demonstration, starting, I think, is it noon or 1 p.m. from Hyde Park, and marching right the way down past MI6 in Vauxhall to the US Embassy just nearby. But I spoke to someone who's at Speaker's Corner in central London every Sunday afternoon this week. His name's Heiko Koo, to ask him what he thought of Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins having their Twitter accounts returned to them at the beginning of the week. It almost seems as if this has been done deliberately to recruit as many far-right people around the country to come down to London tomorrow as possible.
I saw some videos posted on Tommy Robinson's Twitter yesterday, and it was all things alleging that foreigners imports, like an object, you know, not really human. So it's a most unfortunate thing. I, to be honest with you, I don't think they're going to get the turnout they think they're going to get, even though there is a certain sentiment in some parts of Britain to attack foreigners or to blame people, immigrants, for problems in Britain, and understandably raising issues about people coming from other countries and getting facilities when economic conditions are bad in Britain. Of course, that's understandable sentiment, and that's a sentiment all over Europe, not only Europe, but even in Pakistan, Afghans are being driven out of refugee camps because the economic circumstances in Pakistan are terrible, and therefore a sentiment develops around that. Of course, if you want any unity amongst the people, you have to try to oppose those type of things. So I think that there is an attempt to generate this conflict. I don't think it's going to come to a head anytime soon, but it's laying the foundations for new types of internal conflict in British society, which nobody should want, but some people are trying to stoke up.
Now, I can remember in the Thatcher era seeing the first homeless on the streets of London. We've also had the Home Secretary talking about this as a lifestyle choice, saying, I mean, we actually have a group, Bristol Housing Action, here in Bristol, which is dishing out tents to the homeless. And she says that we should stop doing that, and implying perhaps that over the winter that people should be freezing to death on the street.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this the last few days, and there really needs to be a proper squatters movement again that occupies buildings and makes them available to the homeless people, because this is becoming ridiculous.
Almost returning back to the housing issue we were talking about earlier at the end there, but what do you make of this this potential clash tomorrow, and the conflict over in the Middle East, which actually is a British generated conflict if you go back far enough? Allenby taking over this in the First World War, pushing out the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire moving in, and then the British at the end of the Second World War handing this territory over to the brand new Israeli state. We have really stoked this fire over the decades, Jeff.
I'm very wary of commenting on a situation that I don't fully understand. And I genuinely don't understand. I go back to the comments I made earlier. We need a situation where everybody treats each other with respect. And you're not easily going to solve that situation in the Middle East. But I very much hope that what happens in London tomorrow is peaceful and respectful of both those who are wanting to celebrate the Armistice Day, but also of those who've got a very valid reason to be protesting. And
at the heart of the conflict over in Gaza is this concept that the Israelis seem to want to eradicate Hamas. But the thing is that there are 2 million Gazans in there, and they've not given them a way out. And the deprivation mm-hmm. of food, water, and particularly medical supplies, as well as the bombing of hospitals, even the Secretary-General, we were hearing from him in a little while actually, the Secretary-General of the United Nations has called for an immediate ceasefire, because we cannot see hospitals being bombed in this way, and doctors being asked to treat thousands of patients who have been, killed in bombings, or obviously not the ones that have been killed, injured in bombings, without medical supplies being allowed in.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't believe one outrage that Hamas perpetrated justifies another outrage that's being perpetrated as a result of that. And that's where, I don't feel happy with what is going on, and there has to be a way that recognises the majority of the people involved are totally innocent and have nothing... And are suffering for something that they had no control over or no influence over. So I recognise there's got to be some mechanism that delivers peace, but how you do that when there's the level of friction out there, and when Israeli citizens went through what they went through over that weekend. So I do not see a simple solution, and I have to say, if I'm, and it's very mundane in comparison, but I'm challenged enough having an opinion on Bristol's problems, and I look at this and recognise it needs people with far more skill and far more ability than I've got to actually bring about a solution.
Armistice Day means ceasefire in the First World War. It was the end of the First World War.
I really do believe peace in every way is what we need. I hope I'm not part of a fortunate generation in this country that's had a relative period of peace. I hope that continues. But yeah, to me, peace is the most important thing, and we should be
Hang on, Jeff, because the Israelis are saying that a ceasefire would benefit Hamas, therefore they will not stop bombing.
Yeah, and they are saying, whilst Hamas still hold hostages, and I mean, each side's got arguments, and the problem is the people who support each side have a reason to believe what their side is saying. And to be honest, it's now too serious. It's escalating, and I only hope the big national powers try to persuade both sides to calm down and ease down and stop this from developing even more seriously.
Yeah, it may bring in even more other countries. Anyway, look, you've had your say on all that. Thanks ever so much for joining us, Jeff. And we're going to be hearing now from a former Labour MP whose name is Gerald Kaufman. He gave a speech after one of the last attacks on Gaza by the Israelis back in January 2009. So we're going to have a listen to that full speech now, and then get on chatting more, much more, about what's been happening in Gaza and maybe what's going to be happening tomorrow too.
I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and a Zionist. On a shelf in our kitchen was a tin box of the Jewish National Fund, into which we put coins to help the pioneers building a Jewish presence in Palestine. I first went to Israel in 1961, and I've been there since, more times than I can count. I had family in Israel, and I have friends in Israel. One of them fought in the wars of 1956, 1967, and 1973, and was wounded in two of them. The tie-clip which I'm wearing is made from a campaign decoration awarded to him, which he presented to me. I've known most of the prime ministers of Israel, starting with the founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Golda Meir was my friend. So was Yigal Alon, the deputy prime minister, who as a general won the Negev for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. My parents came to Britain as refugees from Poland. Most of their families were subsequently murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. My grandmother was ill in bed when the Nazis came to her hometown of Staszów. A German soldier shot her dead in her bed. Madam Deputy Speaker, my grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. The present Israeli government ruthlessly and cynically exploit the continuing guilt among Gentiles over the slaughter of Jews in the Holocaust as justification for their murder of Palestinians. The implication is that Jewish lives are precious, but the lives of Palestinians do not count. On Sky News a few days ago, the spokeswoman for the Israeli army, Major Leibovich, was asked about the Israeli killing of, at that time, 800 Palestinians. The total is now 1,000. She replied instantly, 500 of them were militants. That was the reply of a Nazi. I suppose that Jews fighting for their lives in the Warsaw Ghetto could have been dismissed as militants. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserts that her government will have no dealings with Hamas because they're terrorists. Tzipi Livni's father was Eitan Livni, Chief Operations Officer of the terrorist Irgun Svai Leumi, who organised the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, in which 91 victims were killed, including four Jews. Israel was born out of Jewish terrorism. Jewish terrorists hanged two British sergeants and booby-trapped their corpses. Irgun, together with the terrorist Stern Gang, massacred 254 Palestinians in 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin. Today, the present Israeli government indicate that they will be willing, in circumstances acceptable to them, to negotiate with the Palestinian President Abbas of Fatah. It's too late for that, Madam Deputy Speaker. They could have negotiated with Fatah's previous leader, Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. Instead, they besieged him in a bunker in Ramallah, where I visited him. It's because of the failings of Fatah since Arafat's death that Hamas won the Palestinian election in 2006. Hamas is a deeply nasty organization, but it was democratically elected, and it is the only game in town. The boycotting of Hamas, including by our own government, has been a culpable error from which dreadful consequences have followed. The great Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban, with whom I campaigned for peace on many platforms, said, "You make peace by talking to your enemies." However many Palestinians the Israelis murder in Gaza, they cannot solve this existential problem by military means. Whenever and however the fighting ends, there will still be 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and 2.5 million more Palestinians in the West Bank, who are treated like dirt by the Israelis, with hundreds of roadblocks and with the ghastly denizens of the illegal Jewish settlements harassing them as well. The time will come, not so long from now, when they will outnumber the Jewish population in Israel. It's time for our government to make clear to the Israeli government that its conduct and policies are unacceptable, and to impose a total arms ban on Israel. It is time for peace, but real peace, not the solution by conquest, which is the Israelis' real goal, but which is impossible for them to achieve. They're not simply war criminals, they're fools.
Well, that's one Jew's view. Martin, I think that's an absolutely amazing part. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Gerald Kaufman there, former shadow foreign secretary. Absolutely unbelievable to hear someone saying those things. The idea is that the present Israeli government are racists, and they're simply abusing this whole concept of anti-Semitism in order to try and bamboozle the Gentiles of the world into supporting what is actually a Nazi regime.
Well, I mean, as we know, there's been all sorts of things said about this in the last few weeks.
But I think, in a way, and, it's because it's, you know, he's not with us anymore. Coming from somebody like him, who's genuinely lost family in the Holocaust, this has much more power.
Well, it does. I mean, on the demonstration in Bristol last Saturday, I was talking to several Jews who were on the demonstration, including a very old lady who had lost her family in the Holocaust, and they were demonstrating against what was happening. And of course, in the US, Jews for Peace have been doing a fantastic job of standing up to be counted. They occupied Grand Central Station. They occupied the Congress. And these are young Jews, and they've been taken away and arrested for protesting against what the Israeli government's doing.
And
as Jews, they're not going to stand for it.
NAMOD organisation in London, which is really, I'd not come across them before. But anyway, the person who's kind of in charge, absolutely in charge, we're going to hear the second of two clips from the King's speech this week. I thought, when he was talking about unlicensed pedicabs in London, I just thought, well, what's this doing in the King's speech? I thought, well, maybe he's just, you know, being driven around as King Charles is, and there's big pedicabs in the way, and he's like, ooh, what's all these things? Yeah, we'll get rid of them. There's no license, you know. So that finds its way into the King's speech.
It's written by the government.
Well, yeah, I know.
He just reads it out, doesn't he?
Look, don't pretend that King Charles just reads what he's told to read. He will be making sure that the people are in place that write the things that he wants to read. And from Patrizia this week, the poem is all about the King's speech, the first one for 50 years since George VI, Charlie's Big Day. Decked out in ermine, diamonds and gold, reading from parchment a speech he was sold. Fingers like sausage, heavy words he did read, new bills alarming to the public did feed. Circumstance and pomp, his words all fell flat, apart from on sycophants who believe in all that. Anything on table he will agree, so can stay, living it large in luxury each day. He looked quite depressed for us, no appeal, tangled in loyalty to the WEF and its spiel. The UK be greater, seems these devils have plans to share all our data, hidden, underhand. Charlie on throne, no loyalty to us, selling us out, without any fuss, our government, he droned. My ministers will do the best on inflation. wildly not true. Zero to carbon by 20 and 50, a load of hot air, clearly to see. Freedoms and bills brought forward, he droned. Jobs and more growth, we wish he'd go home. Self-driving cars is a load of old bunk. If we didn't know better, we would think he were drunk. Bored Charlie sounded, reeling a load of hot air. Keeping us safe, as if the government care. Security, blah, blah, support veterans the same. Nothing ever changes, it's all a sad game. Our country's captured a coup. 'Tis now clear, a globalist agenda, which Charlie will steer. Thanks, Patrizia. So anyway, let's have a listen now to what his take on, because this is always, for me, the most interesting, is what is going to be said in the King's speech about foreign policy.
My government will continue to champion security around the world, to invest in our gallant armed forces, and to support veterans to whom so much is owed. My ministers will work closely with international partners to support Ukraine, strengthen NATO, and address the most pressing security challenges. This includes the consequences of the barbaric acts of terrorism against the people of Israel, facilitating humanitarian support into Gaza, and supporting the cause of peace and stability in the Middle East.
So, the barbaric Hamas. Support Ukraine and NATO. So this is an extremely political, what he's saying here, isn't it? So we support the Israelis, we don't support Hamas, they're barbaric, and we also support NATO and Ukraine.
Well, yes, I mean, it is a political speech, but it's read out by the king in this case, but it's written by, effectively, by Rishi Sunak and his advisers. And the policy of Britain is to carry on supporting the war in the Ukraine, even though it's lost and thousands, hundreds of thousands are dead, and to carry on supporting the Israeli destruction of the people of Gaza, because that's part of US policy, and we just do what the US says, Tony. That's the policy.
So when I spoke to Heiko Kuh, who's he's got his own, he does the Marxist tours of London, and he also does speaks at Speaker's Corner on a Sunday afternoon, I thought it was absolutely fascinating that he had quite a lot to say about I mentioned the ULEZ to him, the clean air zone, supposed clean air zone thing in London, but he said, well, actually this is really about surveillance, it's nothing to do with clean air or anything else, they're just checking, not only are they checking on every car movement, but the it's the first I didn't realise that the cameras that are used for checking on the number plates for ULEZ are also capable of doing facial recognition. So maybe every vehicle and person that moves around London is going to become a little dot on a computer somewhere.
I mean, I remember in the 1980s, perhaps early 90s, it was said that London was the most camera-up city in the world. At that time, of course, it was someone would have to sit watching it. Now, the idea is the dystopian dreams of these AI freaks that they can permanently monitor people and identify people and check what their sentiments are and all the rest of it. I think it will never really work out the way they imagine, but try they do in every way, you know, from the vaccine passports to the, you know, ULEZ to facial recognition. They just keep trying and trying and trying. And of course, they do like to have test bed experiments. And Gaza, of course, after the destruction that will take place now, will almost certainly be, you know, the most surveyed place in the world. Everyone there will just be watched permanently. Quite apart from their phone communications, that will all be integrated together with. So, you know, you create some model which you can try and sell somewhere around the world. I don't think it will bring much benefit to them, but they you know, as I say, try they will, because they can sell these things on.
Okay, so if people are interested in seeing you, I understand you and Piers Corbyn will both be speaking on Saturday, but also maybe joining you during the march from Hyde Park down to, well, it's actually just down the road from MI6 headquarters in Vauxhall, the American embassy.
Yeah, we will be setting up an amplifier somewhere along the route. We're not exactly sure yet actually where, probably around Vauxhall Bridge roadway, just to encourage people to get up and speak and give their point of view, because these demonstrations, the problem with it is, one is they're so big that by the time the speakers have started speaking, very few people get to hear them anyway. They tend to be the same speakers every week, and I don't see any reason why, you know, when you've got 500,000 people plus, that people with different points of view shouldn't be able to get up and speak, and other people than just, you know, the high and mighty and famous should speak. And so as I've been speaking at Speakers Corner for many years, I've always tried to encourage that on demonstrations. People get up. Perhaps, you know, in the 1890s, when Speakers Corner was first sort of becoming a thriving environment, they used to have 20, 30 platforms, and I would suggest that that's what really needs to happen, rather than just have people march like the Duke of York up and down a hill. You should have platforms all over where people get up and express their point of view, not only about the issue of Gaza, but why the British government supports it, the type of issues that we've been discussing, and encourage people to come forth with, you know, with agreeing or opposing views. I would like the Jewish people who are going on the demonstrations against the Palestinians to attend these demonstrations and discuss with people. I think there needs to be debate between all different sides in this war, in an environment where they're not at war, or all different sides in this genocide, in an environment where the people are not affected, where they can directly affected, where they can discuss and debate with each other. We've had that at Speaker's Corner the last few weeks. We've had Jewish people, Muslim people standing next to each other and discussing, debating, and you'll be surprised how people are able to get along, even over such contentious issues. And
right, it makes it sound almost like, in the face. Yeah, almost like pre-1948 over in Jerusalem. That sort of thing would have been going on all the time. But anyway, exactly. Look, if people are interested in either coming, if they're visiting London one Sunday or...
Speaker's Corner any Sunday afternoon. Or they can catch me if they're interested in Karl Marx. They can come on the Karl Marx Walking Tour at 11 o'clock. Online, they can catch the marxwalks.com or speakerscorner.net. It's my stuff.
Okay, hi, Koku. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you'll hear his dulcet tones, hopefully ringing, unless there's some sort of hideous arrest takes place, across Hyde Park and elsewhere along during the length of the march. And I think it's around about 3:30, 4 o'clock, they'll be back, I think, at Hyde Park doing something too. But anyway, yes, you can find out all about that on Heiko's website, and also the Stop New Normal website of Piers Corbyn. You'll also find stuff about that. But Martin, this is, I think, an interesting little idea he's got there, which is let's give some a voice to those. Well, I mean, we're expecting many hundreds of thousands of people to turn up on tomorrow on Saturday.
Yeah, well, in 2003, the anti-Iraq war march, we had 66 coaches going from Bristol to London, and we had gathered together the stewards for those coaches the night before. So every coach had two stewards on it, two people who were going to be looking after the people on their coach. And what we said to them was, on the way down to the demonstration, instead of people just sitting in their seats and chatting to each other, you've got to get up to the front. You've got to give them all the basic information about how give them your phone number so that they can phone you if they get lost and all this sort of stuff, basic stuff about where the coaches were likely to be and all the rest of it. And then when you've done that, we want you to say to the people on the bus why you are going on the demonstration. And then encourage people to come up and tell everybody else why they're going to the demonstration. Because it's a 2.5-hour drive down there. We're not going to waste that time. And so on my bus, I said all this on my speech, and then various people came up and said why they were going on the demonstration. So, for example, we had a Japanese person who was going on the demonstration because they were a Buddhist. So then they talked about that. Other people talked about why they were going on it and so on. And of course, demonstrations can be interactive and not just, you know, top down, as it were. During the 1991 Gulf War, the run up to the 1991 Gulf War, I went down to Speaker's Corner every day for 5 weeks before the war broke out. And I was encouraging people to occupy Speaker's Corner permanently. We'll just have a permanent camp where we will continuously discuss what's going on. And of course, that does happen. That's what the Maidan Square was initially in Ukraine. And of course,
that it happened in the Arab Spring in Tahrir Square.
Yeah, exactly. So in other words, Cairo. This is actually a recognised tactic. But, you know, you can only do so much of that when you've got everybody to bus down to London.
This is only
They've
needed.
Got to march from Asia. They've only, got to get buses
I mean,
home
we,
again.
This is only needed when democracy is broken, isn't it?
No, you need it even when you've got democracy that's functioning. You're going to want people to be able to speak, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it's very, very encouraging to have this in this real world in person, political interaction, in a world where everyone is on social media, is doing everything digitally.
Just to say, in open Egypt, that was one of the reasons people did come out on the streets, because the various social media was shut down by the government.
Yeah.
The internet was shut down. The next day, everyone was out on the street.
It makes me think, you know, I've spoken to you on here about Ernest Bevin in Bristol, and the world, the Bristol world, the Edwardian world in Bristol that made him. And a big part of that was that on a Sunday, you'd go to the park and stand up on a box and debate the current issues of the day. And that was where it was in those situations that he found his voice, his ability to be an orator and how you worked out what you believed.
In the King's Speech, there was talk about crackdown on crime, as they normally do, but hidden in amongst this new bill.
So the bill would also give police powers to search a property without a court warrant if they've got reliable proof that a stolen item is inside. And this is partly in response to the fact that you can track mobile phones.
Yeah.
So I could have my mobile phone stolen. I could say to the police, find my phone is telling me it's in that house. And now the police don't need a warrant
to go and get that. This is a truly terrible idea. I mean, look, the right not to have your house invaded by the state, which is what the police are, is as fundamental a part of our liberties as jury trials, as a presumption of innocence, and so on. And what this is saying is you're going to let the Metropolitan Police, who have got such a good reputation, make this decision. Now, the whole point about this is you go to a magistrate or a judge, and you can do it in the middle of the night. If you're a copper, you know, you've got the duty magistrate, you call him up, you say, look, we have got evidence on the mobile phone that the phone is in there. That's enough evidence to persuade him. So, you know, you still go through the process. It's still
why are they seeking this power then?
I don't know. I mean, look, I mean, the police are forever asking for extra powers. Mostly they don't need them. You know, the laws are all there, they're just not using them properly. And they keep asking for this, and the Home Office gives in, I'm afraid. You know, I think this is a Queen's, oh, sorry, here we go,
yeah.
King's Speech, which is pretty much free of gimmicks, but I make an exception for this.
So that's the Conservative MP David Davis there. There's also I'll put up on our show page the full version of that, and plus one of our local MPs, Jacob Rees-Mogg, weighed in on this. He thinks it's a terrible idea. I mean, it does sound a bit lazy, Martin, doesn't it? The idea that you can't be bothered to go to a magistrate, so you're just going to go bang and knock someone's door down without a warrant.
Well, I wonder whether they've actually asked the police whether they want these powers. I doubt it. They've probably just pulled this out of a hat as a way of, they've got to say something in the last King's Speech, before they're banished to the outer darkness. So they just come
so
up with
this
a series
from,
of...
So where does this come from, then? Is it Swell a Braver Man?
It's coming from
the idea with King Charles?
Well, the idea, it'll be the sort of thing that the people who write opinion pieces in the Daily Express want to hear. And that's quite important if you want to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. Tough on crime. Tough on crime.
Yeah, but this
very
idea
tough.
Of eroding civil
very, very
liberties,
tough.
We don't need to do that as well, do we?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, basically, the idea that the Tory government, after all these years, has suddenly had a road to Damascus moment and realised that they've not been tough enough on crime, it just makes me groan. I mean, there is a big problem with crime in this country because we've got an illegal drugs market, because drugs are illegal, and because people haven't got any money, so they start stealing things. That's clearly been happening ever since the cost of living crisis. There's a massive increase in shoplifting. And it's also, and of course, there are issues here. The people who run shops are unhappy that the police don't actually chase up the shoplifters. But that's because the police haven't got the resources to chase up shoplifters, because they're doing all sorts of other stuff. And, you know, these things can't be solved by gimmicks. Gimmicks are gimmicks. The police need to be taught you know, you need to talk to the actual police about what they think the problems are, and then come up with some solutions that are workable, rather than just pulling ideas out of a hat.
Okay, before we get back to Gaza, I always think when it's King's Speech time, it's a good time to sort of just review everything to do with our whole political system and how it works. I want to just ask, before we hear this next clip, I'll just ask you both what you think of this whole idea of having bishops in the House of Lords. Maybe you first, Martin. Because there was a piece about this a few weeks ago on Radio 4's Sunday programme, which I found quite fascinating. You know, how do the bishops vote? Who are they? What do they do? Why should they be there?
Well, they've been there ever since the Middle Ages, because the House of Lords used to be the House of Lords, temporal and spiritual.
We can change all that if we want to, can't we?
Yes, we could either decide to abolish the bishops from the House of Lords. Lots of people in the Church of England, like my parents, want the Church of England disestablished. They don't want it to be part of the state. So for them, not having bishops in the House of Lords would be, you know, that would be part of that.
I mean,
get rid of the House of Lords.
I look at the Lords now. I don't know what you make of this, Joe, but I look at the Lords now as actually quite a moderating influence. We've had all sorts of laws over the last, 10 years, 13 years or so. From the Tories and the coalition government, where the only people who have been reining this back are the Lords. I mean, one of them, for example, is this stuff to do with smart meters. It was the Lords that started the process of stopping entry into people's houses to force-fit smart meters. There was also... it slips my mind, but there are, I mean, you can help me here, Martin, if you wish, but there are some measures where the House of Lords were actually adamant about, no, this is not going to work, and so you can't do it. I think maybe it was student loans.
Brexit,
or something.
Brexit, Tony.
No.
Remember Brexit?
Yeah.
The House of Lords blocked Brexit.
Well, they didn't, actually, no.
Well, no, they didn't in the end, because they were overruled, because the system works like that.
I think you're deliberately trying to steer us down a little wormhole of your own making. Actually, the House of Lords, what do you make of all this, Joe?
I've got some sympathy for that. I'm not in favour of a totally elected House of Lords, because I think you would narrow the kind of people you got in there. But obviously there are massive problems with the corrupt nature of, you know, these people being put in there, but
yeah, political appointments,
appointments for loyalty and all the rest of it, and you know, the funding for the Conservative Party or whoever, the Labour Party, so it needs to be cleaned up. But yeah, the issue with the bishops, I mean, I find it appealing that you get that. You get a range of experience there that you wouldn't get simply if they were sort of political and voted in.
Yeah, so I think what you've got historically is that the Commons were largely representing the capitalist class, the post-Civil War capitalist class, and the Lords, up until a few years ago anyway, were representing the feudal landed class. And so they obviously didn't agree on everything, but the idea was that so long as it's okay with the big landowners and the big capitalists, it will become law. Helen Grady did this report for the BBC Radio 4 Sunday programme a couple of weeks ago.
Are Church of England bishops sitting in the House of Lords biased against the government? That was the allegation, you may remember, made on this very programme by the Conservative MP Chris Loder earlier this month. He claimed that the Lords spiritual, to give them their official title, had become politicians wearing mitres, and that the evidence shows they've voted against the government in the House of Lords 96% of the time in the period since 2017. Helen Grady has been digging into the bishops' voting record in the Lords.
The House of Commons Library told us that 94.5% of votes cast by bishops since 2017 were against the government. That number is for whipped votes, where peers with a party affiliation would be expected to vote along party lines. Chris Loder's slightly higher 96.1% didn't account for bishops changing posts during a parliamentary session. We managed to get hold of voting records that go back to 1999, and they showed a general trend for bishops to vote against the government of the day. The data shows that between 1999 and 2010, so during Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's Labour governments, the bishops voted against the government 59% of the time. Between 2010 and 2015, when the Conservatives were sharing power with the Liberal Democrats, 78% of the bishops' votes were against the government. And if we look at the period between 2015 and last month, so that's under David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, they voted against those purely Conservative governments 88% of the time. When we plotted the votes on a graph, there is variation in how the bishops vote within parliamentary terms, which suggests that it's to do with policy as much as it is to do with political parties. And although there are 26 bishops with seats in the Lords, there are only ever five or six present, and on average, just a couple vote in each division. So you could say maybe those who turn up regularly to vote are more left-leaning, but not necessarily the Lord's spiritual as a whole.
I thought they're interesting figures, actually, and particularly the way things are getting more and more anti-bishop in terms of legislation coming through the House of Lords, or at least they are voting against it. Nearly 9 out of 10 now, Martin, and this has been getting increasing and increasing ever since the Labour government 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, they used to refer to the Church of England as the Conservative Party at prayer. That certainly was how it was perceived in the 19th century. But since then, the Church of England has become a very much smaller organisation in terms of the people who identify with it than it used to be back in those days. And the kind of people who are active in the Church of England, like my parents, tend to be left of centre. So if they're going to be represented in the Lords, which they are, then they're likely to vote against Conservative governments over things like, housing bills, which are going to create homelessness and so on. They would see that if we're going to have a political voice, it's likely to be that sort of thing we're going to say.
You seem to be implying that left means spiritual and moral and right means anti-spiritual, anti-moral.
No, I'm trying to discuss just the demographics of the Church of England. The Church of Scotland, of course, is the established church in Scotland. And, of course, there's plenty of Christians who aren't part of the Church of England. Catholics are not sitting in the House of Lords unless they are put there in some other capacity. And this, of course, is going back to the Civil War and so on.
Yeah, maybe they should be.
The imposition of bishops in Scotland led to the rebellion against the English crown, which led to the Civil War.
Should we have some Orthodox bishops in there and some Catholic bishops too?
Well, maybe we should just get rid of the House of Lords altogether instead of argue about who should be in it. Maybe there shouldn't even be one. Anyway, they don't have one in New Zealand.
Anyway, Joe, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I guess there's the issue of other religions as well. You could have leaders from other religions.
Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims. Gosh, you could have all the mullahs in there. Lucky
well, Baroness Wasi is a prominent Muslim lady who is a bishop. And she was, she's put there by the Conservative Party. Well, she's quite critical of current Conservative policy.
No, she's a Lord. A Baroness.
She's a Baroness, sorry. Yeah, but she's in the House of Lords. She's not a bishop.
They don't have women bishops in the Muslim churches or mosques, I don't think. Not yet, anyway. But she said something very interesting. She said something really interesting about Hamas being funded by the Netanyahu government, Martin, on Question Time the other week.
Yes, that's right. Well, in 2019, Netanyahu spoke to the Likud parliamentary party and he said, yes, we have been funding Hamas. It's a strategy to undermine a two-state solution, because we know that Hamas are opposed to a two-state solution and that they're quite militant, and it's in our interest to give them resources so that they can then do what they do in such a way as to get our result. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet, which I've been reading over the last week or so, about what happened on October the 10th, because it looks like there were 7 hours before the Israeli army pressed the button and got their forces organised to try and sort something out. And
is
when there, they did arrive,
a bit like 9/11, that was funny,
yes, well, that's what they've called it. They've called it Israel's 9/11. And when they did arrive, it's pretty clear that most of the civilians that were killed by the Israeli army. They were killing the hostages. They'd taken loads of hostages in these kibbutzes. The Israeli army arrived and just started whacking the buildings where the hostages were being held, killing the Hamas people holding them, but also killing the hostages.
Right, before,
and 50 hostages have been killed by Israeli bombing inside
before
Gaza.
Before we get deep into Gaza, which we will do in a moment, we're going to have a little musical break, including some Palestinian children's.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell
know. Don't you mind about the future. Don't you try to think ahead. Save tomorrow for tomorrow. Think about today instead.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz?
I could give you facts and figures.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's
happening. Even give you plans and forecasts. Even tell you where I'm going.
When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem?
Why should you want to know? Why are you obsessed with fighting? Times and fates you can't defy. If you knew the path we're riding, you'd understand it less than
I. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try to cool down this bit.
That is good while you prattle through your supper. Where and when and who and how. She alone has tried to give me what I need right here now.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Hi. think sharp on my way from conviction, no fiction. This is my thing. Above the sky, I feel no fear to be here. It's oh so fine, shining brightly like sunlight inside my mind.
Well, know that any mountain is capable of moving. It's even in the new generation who are proving. You can be what you wanna be. Let your soul and your body and your mind be free, one of a kind. We all are that, but going all the way is where I'm at. With delivery smooth like water from a fountain. That's why I can move any mountain.
I can move any mountain.
From 1991, The Shaman, and Move Any Mountain. I'm sure there's some people on all sides in these conflicts that think, yeah, we can do it, whatever, we can just do it. And partly this is an attitude, I think, which is taken by the accelerationists as well as those of us resisting them. So which way the mountain's going to move, we shall see. Sorry, I'm not sure of the title of the Gaza song. Happy to put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Sung by the Palestinian Kids there. But before all that, we got What's the Buzz? And that's from Jesus Christ Superstar back in 1973. Many people thinking and praying about the Christian origins of that part of the world. And we'll be hearing in a little while from an Orthodox Christian who lives in Bethlehem in the West Bank, talking about the whole situation too in a little while. But we're going to start with this chap. Well, I say chap. He's a former national security advisor in Israel, and so he's one of the main people behind the tactics of the Israelis. And he was on the BBC's PM programme earlier this week, where he explains why he thinks, in fact, he's asked about how they managed to be so caught by surprise.
It took some time to organize the plan, but I think the operation that is going for the last almost couple of weeks is going well, in the sense that the operational objectives are being met, and the IDF is successfully avoiding the traps that Hamas clearly put there on the defenses, and we're gradually closing in. And I think what's important to say is that there are clearly two phases here. The first is we need to remove Hamas from power in Gaza. If Ian says that, you know, everybody hears that from Hamas, because they say this in their interviews all the time, that it's not their responsibility to protect their own population. Seriously? I mean, clearly they went into October 7th rampage in Israel without thinking about the implications to their civilian population, and they're using them as human shields. We need to remove them. It's true that once we remove them, this does not promise success and future to the Gazan's people, because there will need to be a more pragmatic leadership there. And it's true that Hamas is an ideology, and it's true that the population in Gaza has been radicalized. Hamas has been in control for 16, 17 years, and Hamas 6, they took over on it. This is going to be a long process, but it has to start when the radicalizing grew in terrorist organization, right, is not in power, yeah, so that there could be some kind of future.
Well, what I would say to that is maybe we need to change the Hamas of the elected government of Palestine. And of course, for the Israelis to say we're not going to deal with them is simply wrong. They're going to have to deal with them one way or the other. We could say that we don't accept the elected government of Israel because they're too extreme, because they don't accept a two-state solution. Therefore, we're not going to negotiate with them, and we're going to remove them from power. That's what we did in Libya when Colonel Gaddafi was supposedly using his aeroplanes to bomb demonstrators who were armed trying to overthrow his regime. There was no use of air power, as a British parliamentary committee concluded, but we used air power, and not only did we stop him using his aircraft, we removed him from power because he wasn't an acceptable person to run Libya. Maybe the current Israeli government are not an acceptable government to run Israel. In the 1940s, when Ernie Bevin was the foreign secretary, that would have been his view. We are not letting these people run.
I mean, there are a lot of people
state.
Who
are
not
there, having a state.
A lot of
at
people
all.
Of all sides, including Israelis, who are very annoyed about the failure for several hours. I don't know how many. Do you know how long it was? About 7 hours for the IDF to actually respond to this incursion. Some are actually also casting doubt on the extent to which the Israelis, Israeli Defense Force, may have been killing civilians who had been captured and who were actually captured and being kept safe, alive, but imprisoned by Hamas.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the number that's being bandied around in the mainstream media, 1,500 Israelis have been killed, and most of these people... Hamas have killed them. But in actual fact...
Babies being beheaded and all sort of thing.
The latest figures I've seen, which are more believable, it's less than 1,000, 900 or so, of which 500 or so were military people, yeah? Police officers, soldiers, etc. And a lot of those were killed in the initial attack. Then they took a lot of hostages, and most of the hostages have been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. So they've got what's called the Hannibal Doctrine.
Well, that's
quite
a big allegation. Hang on a second, because what you're saying there is, of these 1,400 claimed victims of Hamas on the 7th of October, something like 500 of them, leaving 900, would have been military, of a legitimate target. So let's just pick apart what you're saying there. And more than half of that 900, say 500 of those, being killed by the Israeli Defense Force. So actually that means that Hamas may have only killed 400. Is that saying?
Well, it's possibly even worse than that, Tony. Like, as time goes on, more information comes out, obviously. On the day it's happening, nobody knows what's going on. But it looks to me as if what Hamas was doing, they caught the Israeli army by surprise, which is extraordinary, considering all of the non-human sensors that they've got around Gaza. Lots of questions to be asked about that. They managed to get the three battalions which supposedly generally placed there, two of them had been sent to the West Bank, so there's only one battalion left. Also, they seemed to be having a holiday, so everybody was in bed, and Hamas caught them completely by surprise. Believe that if you will. Now, some people are saying Hamas have managed to do this because they've actually worked out how to evade surveillance. Now, that may be true, but I think the Egyptians were saying that we gave them a warning, and it looks fairly clear.
How do we square this with the Greater Israel Bloc, the Israeli government, actually funding Hamas?
Well, it's perfectly straightforward. They funded Hamas as a means of undermining the PLO and the secular nationalists. And they created Hamas in the first place. I mean, the Provisional IRA was infiltrated very heavily by the British Army and British intelligence services by the end of the campaign. But it wasn't created by them, whereas Hamas was indeed created by the Israeli intelligence services. They created it as an Islamist foil to undermine the PLO. And when the election was held in 2006, the Oslo Accords had been agreed. There was going to be a two-state solution. And as part of that, there was an election to a Palestinian authority, which the Palestinian PLO Fatah lost, Hamas won. They should have taken over as the government in both the Gaza and the West Bank. They were not allowed to do that, and the Israelis supported Hamas to... They sent Darlan down, who was a top PLO guy. He went to Gaza to try and smash Hamas. He failed, and Hamas ended up ruling Gaza, and the Palestinian Authority ended up running the West Bank, but they were absolutely under the thumb of the Israelis. The people who live in the West Bank despise them because they're seen as collaborators. Like Mahmoud Abbas, who's the head of the Palestinian Authority, somebody tried to assassinate him the other day. His car was fired at. Not necessarily Hamas militants, because the militants in the West Bank seem to be more aligned with the Popular Front for Liberation Palestine.
I understand also, Martin, that this music festival, that many of the attendees of that music festival may have actually been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces without actually ever having been captured by Hamas people at all.
Is that feasible? That's right. Well, I mean, there's a one woman who survived all of this, and she was captured by Hamas. And she said, it was, you know, when the Israeli Defense Forces arrived, they were just killing everybody. They've got what's called the Hannibal Doctrine, which they've had for quite a long time, because Gilad Shalit, who was one individual soldier, he was captured by Hamas some years ago now, and they were able to swap one individual soldier for 1,100, I think it was, Palestinian prisoners. Because, of course, the Israelis are holding loads of Palestinians as hostages in their prisons. It's not just Hamas holding hostages. Yeah, you see how it's presented in the world. Hamas have got hostages, civilian hostages. This is terrible. But the Israelis have got loads and loads of people in prison, which they haven't charged with any crime, and they're basically hostages. So, but in the past, because of the...
Can I just say something about Yasmin Porritt, who you're talking about, this lady in the kibbutz? Once released, she claimed in the Israeli press that the Israeli government gave her a specific script of talking points that she refused to go along with.
That's right, and the same with the elderly lady. She refused to go along with the script. So, in other words, what it seems to be is that the Hamas are... independent of the Israeli government, but they're heavily infiltrated, and this was allowed to happen because it's a means for the Greater Israel bloc that you referred to earlier to ethnically cleanse or genocide the people of Gaza. Just get rid of the problem. No person, no problem, as Stalin used to say. And that's exactly what the policy was in the 1940s when the Irgun went around killing Palestinians at random.
A fascinating piece, I thought it was very interesting anyway, called The Hannibal Directive, What Really Happened on October the 7th. This is the sort of stuff that you won't be seeing on the mainstream press, and that is on Mint Press News. Possibly even firing out of helicopters at partygoers, thinking, well, actually, we would much rather these people be dead than become hostages taken over by Hamas.
That's right.
That's a pretty extreme way to do things.
Yes, but because in the past Hamas were able to leverage having hostages, including just capturing soldiers, military hostages, they were able to leverage it because public opinion in Israel is quite soft. They don't want their people to die. And a lot of the relatives of the people who are being held are calling for a ceasefire, and they're saying we should release all of our Palestinian prisoners, and then our relatives can be released. Because they're actually from kibbutzes, which is actually they tend to be on the left of Israeli politics. They weren't very keen on Netanyahu in the first place, but they are definitely. I mean, the families of the people who are being held are saying ceasefire negotiations. Let's swap hostages.
Mint Press News has been pretty good on all this, including, we were hearing about the King's speech earlier on, the mask has fallen, they say. King Charles supports Israel. One of the most extraordinary yet unremarked upon developments since Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza began has been the British monarchy's brazen jettisoning of any pretense of political neutrality. Well, we heard that earlier on in the speech itself. Queen Elizabeth II, publicly at least, rigidly refrained from commenting on current affairs or giving the vaguest appearance of taking a particular side on issues throughout her 70-year reign. Within hours of Operation Al-Aqsa flood commencing, King Charles condemned Hamas, saying he was profoundly distressed and appalled by the horrors inflicted by the group and its barbaric acts of terrorism. Hamas is not recognised as a terrorist entity by most countries, and even by the BBC, which has relentlessly manufactured consent for genocide in Gaza, so this article says, since the violence erupted. It rejects the use of this loaded, politicised designation, but obviously King Charles thinks that Hamas are a terrorist organisation.
Yes, and he thinks that Vladimir Zelensky is a great hero and that Putin deserves to die. So no surprises there. He's in line with mainstream establishment thinking, as he would be, because he's part of the mainstream establishment, isn't he?
Anyway, I'll put a link up to that fascinating bit in Mint Press News on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And yeah, I think their coverage has been particularly useful. But Peter Oborne writes for Middle East Eye. He's one of my favourite freelance journalists. He was at the Mail. He's been sort of from pillar to post as he upsets the establishment and gets, and they put the frighteners on his, whoever he's working for, the network or the newspaper in London that he's working for, and he gets moved elsewhere. But he's on Middle East Eye at the moment. The Sunak government, he says this week, intends to broaden the definition of extremism. This is good old Suella Braverman, to include law-abiding organisations like the Muslim Council of Britain and MEND. This weekend, we learnt that with the wake of Israel's war on Gaza, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government intends to broaden the definition of extremism to include anyone who undermines British institution and values, Martin.
Well, I think that they're out of tune with public opinion on this, because it's something like 70% of people in Britain want an immediate ceasefire, and they certainly want the British government to call for an immediate ceasefire. And you saw what Suella Braverman did in this article in The Times, which she hadn't cleared with Rishi Sunak, and various Tories are saying she should be sacked for that. And she's saying that the police, Metropolitan Police, are clearly pro-leftist, because they you know, right-wing demonstrators get treated with much more harshness, and it looks a bit like Northern Ireland. So she's brought Northern Ireland into it, including, you know, the loyalist marches.
Well, it's quite good, and because there's a lot of comparisons between Israel and Northern Ireland, both British-made conflicts.
Yes, I know, but I don't think Suella Braverman understands the sensitivities around Northern Ireland about who's allowed to march where. She doesn't understand anything about
that,
I'm quite sure.
Well, I wondered about all this, and I thought, well, is it maybe that Braverman's been encouraged to do this by one of her special advisors, to just pass an own goal to Starmer and the rest of them?
Well, she's doing it because she intends to be the leader of the Conservative Party after the Conservatives lose the next election. So she is actually playing to the gallery of the 80,000 Tory members who will decide who runs the Tory party.
Yeah, but she's also given Keir Starmer and the Labour Party something to just, well, beat her up with over the next few months in the run-up to the next general election.
One of the few things which has been positive about this is that the Labour Party have called for her to resign because of her attempts to ban tomorrow's march. And Starmer hasn't called for the banning of tomorrow's march. He's sacked various people from his front bench.
Hang on, but Sunak has hauled over the Metropolitan Police Commissioner over the coals yesterday.
Well, he went in on Wednesday to talk with Mark Rowley, and he came out, and Mark Rowley basically told him the truth, which is that the government doesn't have the power to ban marches. It is only the police that can decide, and they will decide purely on the public order aspects of the march. And, you know, he did ask, Rowley said, maybe the organisers could think about calling it off. But they said, well, we're not calling it off. And then he said, well, obviously, if they don't want to call it off, you don't have to call it off, because there's no real danger of disorder. The only real danger of disorder is coming from Tommy Robinson and his chums. If they turn up and cause disorder, that is not the Palestine solidarity campaign.
This new definition of extremism has been dreamt up by Michael Gove's Department of Levelling Up Housing and Communities, the Muslim Council of Britain, Muslim Engagement and Development, which is MEND, and Palestine Action are among the organisations targeted on the basis that they would be captured by the new definition of extremism. And Peter Oborne goes on, beautiful writing, to say, there is a terrible irony here. By this definition, the Sunak government itself should be designated.
Well, that's right. I think what's going on here is infighting within the Tory right wing about how hard line to be over this crisis, because they're jockeying for position about who is going to take Sunak's role after Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister. But anyway, the only positive thing Starmer has done in the last week or so is to say, you know, Suella Braverman should resign, because her rhetoric is making things worse. Yeah. We had Jeff Gollop here, a Tory, saying, well, we need to dial it down a gear. And Sue Anna Brevman isn't dialing it down a gear. She also said that these demonstrators are Islamists, extremists. And it's like Northern Ireland. Jeff Gollop said, well, what? You're talking about Drumcree. Drumcree, is that what we're talking about?
Isn't the Israeli government an extremist organisation?
Well, exactly, I would argue
that's
the case. Is the
Israeli embassy a nest of extremism? I mean, they're behaving like a nuclear-armed doomsday cult.
Well, that's right. In the 1940s, no conservative would have doubted that the Israelis were terrorists. If we're going to use the word terrorists, and as you say, it's loaded, isn't it, to accuse people of being terrorists. You could call them Hamas fighters, for example. We could say IDF terrorists. No doubt people will be chanting that tomorrow. Because the state of Israel was created by vicious, determined terrorists.
Well, look, one of the things
and that's
that
the only reason that it exists.
Since our last show, I think, in fact, he was saying it pretty much as last week's show was going out, was this Israeli heritage minister, Amichai Eliyahu, he said that striking the Gaza Strip with a nuclear bomb is on the table.
Well, that just shows how... I mean, that's just... They are basically becoming psychopathic. I mean, you can't use a nuclear bomb on Gaza, and it wouldn't do any good. I mean, you don't forget that this is very close to Israel, a country the size of Wales. If you dropped a nuclear bomb on Cardiff, it wouldn't make anybody in Bristol any better off, would it? It would just, you know, cause all kinds of problems. But, of course, they are talking, I mean, and they're openly talking of killing everybody in Gaza. The far right in Israel are saying, let's just kill them all off. Let's just get rid of them. No person, no problem. That's exactly what they're talking like. And the British government and the American government are going along with that. Meanwhile, the rest of the world, the whole of Africa, the whole of Latin America, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, everybody else is saying ceasefire now. And I think this is going to be very interesting, because it may be, if it was a false flag, that it's not just an Israeli false flag. Where did all of this armada in the Eastern Mediterranean just suddenly appear from, like a mushroom? You can't get two aircraft carriers into the Eastern Mediterranean by helicopter. They have to sail from somewhere, and they have to. And it looks to me as if this whole thing is a setup to start knocking down things in Lebanon and Syria, and then ultimately going to war with Iran.
Well, talking about Lebanon, they are launching drone attacks on Israeli sites now.
Yes, well, that's all over the Middle East. The US told Netanyahu to slow down the invasion of Gaza because they're bringing in lots of anti-aircraft missiles to their bases in Syria and in Iraq because these are very vulnerable bases. The governments of Syria and Iraq have said to the Americans, you need to take these bases out of our country. We don't want them here. We're going to attack you if you don't take them away.
Well,
and they started attacking
them. What I'm trying to do is get through this interview with Eyal Hulata, the former National Security Council chair. It's fascinating, Evan Davis chat with him. But before we go to the next part of that, let's hear from Netanyahu himself talking about his plans for the future of Gaza.
The Israeli army is pushing deeper into Gaza, the number of dead rising by the hour. The Israelis insist the aim of the war is the destruction of Hamas. But now Benjamin Netanyahu says his forces will oversee security in the Strip for an indefinite period, raising the clear possibility of a level of military occupation.
I think Israel will, for an indefinite period, will have the overall security responsibility, because we've seen what happens when we don't have it. When we don't have that security responsibility, what we have is the eruption of Hamas terror on a scale that we couldn't imagine.
Israel withdrew from its illegal settlements and military positions in Gaza in 2005, finally handing back territory it seized in 1967. Moving troops in for an extended period or indefinite stay would be the first Israeli presence of its kind in 18 years.
From Al Jazeera, that report, Martin. But it's interesting to go into a little bit of the history of this, as he's doing there. But for the Israelis to say, we want control of this now, it starts to look as if that's actually all they really wanted, is they want the land.
They do want the land, not least because there's a gas field just outside Gaza, which, of course, will go to the Israelis if they control that strip of land, which could, in fact, be used to set up a Palestinian state and be the basis of a funded Palestinian state if they developed it. It's British Petroleum who found the gas field. Now, it's not been developed at the moment because there's still dispute about who owns it. But of course, if all the Palestinians in Gaza are either killed or expelled into Sinai, then the Israelis will be the people in control and they get the gas field. Now, talking about what's illegal and what's not illegal in terms of settlements, the people who live around the Gaza Strip, the kibbutzes that are there, they were put in place after the 67 war. Before the 67 war, they weren't there. In the 67 war, that land was captured, and the people who were in Gaza, their grandparents are buried in all of those settlements around Gaza. Yeah. So when the Hamas forces came over the border of Gaza and attacked those kibbutzes, their grandparents are buried underneath those kibbutzes. Those kibbutzes used to be their family's villages. Okay? So when you say that they've got no right to do that, I would say, well, hang on a minute, that used to be theirs. And of course, Israel was given a state in 1948, which was essentially, they were given a lot more land than they deserved, because they were actually quite a small population at that stage, but it's certainly nothing like what they've subsequently taken. And if we're going to stick to the letter of international law, the Israelis, for example, shouldn't be in Jerusalem at all. In 1948, they were specifically forbidden to have any part of Jerusalem, they were not to have it.
Up until the 1980s, it was relatively normal in Gaza, and I thought it'd be interesting to go back to look at those days. And this is an interview with a lady who was from one of the landowning families in Gaza, who was educated actually here at Cheltenham Ladies College. And so here she is. Her name, I'm not sure of her first name, but she's from the Shawa family, that is S-H-A-W-W-A. And her sister was a very famous painter. In fact, she is seen as the mother of resistance painting in Palestine, and had her own gallery there, which had to be shut down a few years ago because of the Israeli bombing and this sort of thing from previous attacks. But anyway, let's just go back to the 1980s to see what life was like in Gaza with the Shawa family.
I wasn't one of those who just could turn my back on this town and say, oh, I originally came from that town and now I'm very happy wherever I am, which would have been a lie. You'll keep something going in Gaza for people who come from the outside to be able to be more or less comfortable and be able to witness and remember, witness what's happening, and remember there's such a place on the map. I do belong to the landed few, the big landowners of Gaza. But we have been in this part of the world for centuries. My grandfather actually was the mayor of Gaza at one time. Then one of my eldest uncles was the mayor. Then my youngest uncle, who passed away last year, was also the mayor of Gaza. In the tradition that they are notables and they are the most respected and perhaps the most powerful, they were at the time mayors. Of course, Gaza doesn't have a mayor now. Nobody wants to be mayor. They run everything as they please. Since the age of 13, I was an American and British schools up to the time I graduated from university. In England, I went to Cheltenham Ladies College. Very many people asked me, did you enjoy it? I didn't enjoy one bit of it. But I kept thinking, well, it's a bit like a bitter pill. You have to swallow it because it's good for you. They had us on the run the whole day, changing shoes, putting hockey things on, taking hockey things off, indoor shoes, outdoor shoes, coats, Macintoshes. We were forever changing. And, of course, doing sports, which was my great problem at school because I had never played this most terrible game called lacrosse.
We're coming for the feast.
Yes, the feast. Today is Zaid, and it being the first day of Zaid, our first duty is to visit the dead very, very early in the morning, and later on to go and pay our respects to our elders, elder members of the family. Of course, there used to be a kind of fair before in Gaza where children could swing and buy all kinds of sweets and have real fun. And I have a photograph of myself in one of these fairs. With the Intifada especially, nobody really feels like having fun or anything like that when you know how many people have lost their children and their relatives in this Intifada. It's a very great number, I can't recall it, but we all feel that the rejoicing for the Eid has been very much tempered down and hush-hushed. There are people who are engaged in day-to-day struggle and efforts directed towards this aim to be independent. We have no identity. We have no proper identity. We are people who owned things and owned land and owned property and completely thrown out and become destitute. I mean, you'd have to react. Because I'm not happy when somebody comes and says, oh, we hate the Jews, we can't bear the Jews. I don't like it. We don't hate the Jews. We hate what the Israeli government is doing, that's for sure. One third of the area of the Gaza Strip, the Israelis have taken over and made their settlements on it. Mostly it's on the coast, therefore it's beautiful land just on the seashore. If asked, they are absolutely certain that this is their land. And when asked further, how do you come to this conclusion? They say, well, God gave it to us. Simple as that. Of course, there's no logic in all this, and there's a lot of pain as well.
So that's a member of the Shawa family. I don't think it's... the famous one in the family is Layla, L-A-I-L-A, the painter, and the name is spelled S-H-A-W-W-A. And so, but anyway, I thought Martin's a fascinating little insight there into life in the 1980s over in that part of the world. Interesting, isn't it, that the Israelis, as they started to steal land in Gaza, they, which of course is all against the UN resolutions, so that it's not their land, that they're just moving in and taking it by force, and it's all along the coast. That's what they're saying. It's all the nice, the real estate.
Well, that's right, and I think also I just want to reiterate that because the right-wing Israeli government isn't interested in a two-state solution, the 1967 borders of Israel, which are the basis of the two-state solution, are now off the table as far as Hamas and lots of other people are concerned. If you're not interested in a two-state solution, that means that you've got to be put... ultimately, I think the only legitimate legal Israeli state is within the 1948 borders. Now, of course, that sounds completely impossible to say something like this at this stage, because they're dominant. They're trying to push everybody out of Gaza or kill them. They're going to try and push everybody out of the West Bank or kill them. But in actual fact, they've got no right to any of that in international law. Now, in international law, if people are, and there are plenty of resolutions against Israel going right back to 1948. And ultimately, they're so strong that they think that they don't have to take any notice of that. But I'll say this to them. The Balfour Declaration came out at the end of World War One. The State of Israel was created at the end of World War Two, within very, very circumscribed boundaries, basically Greater Tel Aviv. This is now World War Three, and at the end of World War Three, certain states will not exist.
Well, I wonder what will happen to the West Bank, because I spoke to this chap, Professor Mazim Kumzie. He's a biologist at the university in Bethlehem. And I spoke to him about what life is like over there right now, a little exclusive. But I particularly asked him about this whole situation where, you know, for many people in Gaza and the West Bank, in the various occupied territories, many of them are thinking, listen, the Israelis are maniacs. We need to leave here.
Don't you ever get, and you and your family ever think, well, this is all going against us, it's time to get out?
You mean for me to leave the country? I mean, it's our country. There are many Palestinians who live outside the country because they couldn't survive here. Of course, there are people who are in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. I'm not sure they're happy being outside their own country, even if the situation is slightly better in Jordan, for example, than the West Bank. And the West Bank certainly better than Gaza now. But regardless, I mean, people want to live in their own country. They love their country. And I love my country. I was born here. My father was born here. My ancestors, I could trace them 1,700 years here. So... we are not interested in being relocated to somewhere else.
Well, many British people would say the same, you know, say, for example, if a country was to invade us, like the Normans did, you know, in 1066, there was a lot of resistance to that, obviously. But look, final question really has got to be, where do you think this is going realistically? Where is it heading, this business in Gaza now?
Well, I think there's two routes. There's the win-win situation, there's the lose-lose. Win-win, if Israel was forced to implement international law, human rights, equality for everybody, we could live either in two states or as one state with the right of refugees to return to all their lands, and this would be equality, justice for everybody. That's a win-win scenario. A lose-lose scenario is the West continues to arm Israel, which is run by genocidal, suicidal, also maniacs like Netanyahu, are willing to bring Armageddon to the Middle East with nuclear weapons. They are even started talking about nuking Gaza, you know, dropping nuclear bomb in Gaza. And that will be a lose-lose situation for everybody. There is no win-lose here. Israel is not going to win. Zionism is not going to last. So they have to realize that they can choose one of those two roads. I am optimistic that the first solution will happen, which is equality, justice, human rights. But we have to push for it.
But there is also the possibility, as some people are saying, that the Israelis are behaving like a kind of doomsday cult. You know, they will push it as far as necessary and possibly with nuclear weapons and bring in other world powers.
Yes, indeed. They are talking genocidal terms when Netanyahu himself is invoking the Bible and the killing of the Canaanites that God told him that Canaanites, men, women, and children can be killed in the Bible. Palestinian thing, men, women, children can be killed. And they are voting, you know, that they are facing human beings, as the Minister of Defense said, that we are human animals, and that's why it's okay to blockade water and food and everything from us. It's crazy. I mean, it's genocidal, but it's so suicide, because there's no way they can succeed in killing the Palestinians in the 21st century. And we will continue to struggle and live on our land, and they have to change their views. And unfortunately, you know, the enabling by the United States and the Zionists and the lobbies in Western capitals like London and Washington, D.C., that get rid of politicians who try to speak truth. These lobbies have to be faced and have to be challenged. Otherwise, we're all in trouble. I'm not just talking about Palestinians, also Israelis.
Well, that's a voice from Bethlehem tonight, Martin, talking about everyone being in trouble. If this isn't this particular boil is not lanced.
Well, the danger for people listening to this in this country is that we may end up in a war with Iran and Russia in order to keep the Israelis in the style to which they've become accustomed.
By the way, that's Professor Mazim Kumzier. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Fascinating insight into what's going on over there. I mean, they have a relatively easy time in the West Bank, aren't they?
Not really.
Relatively.
Relatively speaking, but I think 100-something people have been killed in the West Bank since the crisis began, this recent crisis. And in normal times, that would be regarded as a fairly horrifying total. But of course, we're now dealing with the deaths of tens of thousands of people in Gaza. The actual death toll is far higher than the one we've heard, because horrifyingly enough, hundreds of people are trapped under the rubble. Can you imagine dying like that? Under the rubble, because you don't die straight away. You're trapped under tons of rubble. You can just about breathe, and you take 3 or 4 or 5 days to die. Horrifying.
So let's go back to the interview we started with half an hour ago or so with Eyal Hulata. This is the former chair of the National Security Council, getting really to the heart of the Israeli war machine. Now, he's been talking to Evan Davis on the BBC about we must eliminate them, but Evan asks him who exactly is them.
Do you actually have a route to getting from killing them or eradicating them? And I suppose I'm not quite sure when you say that, them, who you mean. Do you mean the top 100 Hamas officials, everybody who's ever been a member?
No, of course not. We're not going to go from a tunnel to tunnel and kill them all. This is unrealistically operationally. When enough of their leadership is down, then they cannot make their decision making on the operational side. And when I was national security advisor and we had a conflict, a round of firing with Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, we had a ceasefire and we spoke through the Egyptians, it was very clear who was on the other side of the phone when the Egyptians made that call. And this will be an indication this time as well. If on the other side of the phone are the same Hamas leaders who make the calls, who, by the way, won't release our hostages, I will be very happy to see them releasing hostages, but at the moment they are not willing to do so. As long as this is the case and they are making decision, it means that Hamas is still in control, and it means that their considerations are to kill Jews rather than to take care of their own people. As long as this is the case, we will need to continue, because otherwise there can be no other future in Gaza.
So that's Eyal Hulata. He's what he's saying, Martin, really doesn't seem to make sense militarily. We've had the announcement this week that something they are saying, the Israelis, that something like 500 Hamas fighters have been killed. Well, actually, there's over 10,000 have been killed. So that means that roughly one in every 20 people the Israelis are killing is one of the people that they're actually after. But of course, at the end of the day, there are many more thousands, if not tens of thousands, who are becoming much more sympathetic to Hamas because of the brutal way in which so many civilians are being killed.
Well, that's right. It's delusionary, isn't it? I mean, they've negotiated. I mean, don't forget, Hamas was created by the Israeli secret services, so they know who they are. They created them, and they have in the past, each previous round of lawn mowing that's gone on in Gaza has ended in a ceasefire in which Hamas has negotiated directly or indirectly with the Israelis, and it's usually been about the release of hostages. And it's quite straightforward. We will release our hostages if you release the Palestinian prisoners that you are holding. Because this isn't in the mainstream media. Don't forget, the Israelis are holding hundreds of thousands of Palestinians as hostages. They're not prisoners of war. They're not been convicted in the courts. It's just administrative detention. And people have been held for 20 years in these conditions. But that doesn't seem to register. That's illegal. Yeah, if Hamas is holding hostages is illegal, well, Israeli holding hostages is illegal. So the obvious solution to that is everybody release the hostages, which I presume was the goal of Hamas. But I think what Hamas have failed to recognise is that the Israeli government, this current Israeli government, doesn't care about the lives of the hostages. That's why they ordered the IDF to kill everybody when they went in on the 10th. and why they're bombing Gaza now. The Hamas have said...
You mean the 7th?
Yeah, 7th. Hamas have said that 50 of the hostages they are holding have been killed by the Israeli bombing. Now, the Hamas have released some of the hostages. They've been negotiating with quite a few of these hostages have in fact got dual nationality. They were not born in Israel. They were born in Russia or in America in Britain.
US Secretary
and
of State,
they've actually got British passports, Russian passports, And those people are then negotiating with the governments of those countries to release those hostages.
US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been touring the zone. He's lamented that the civilian death toll in Gaza on Friday, it marked a subtle but notable shift in US language towards the Israeli government. For weeks, the Biden administration has been backing Netanyahu's military offensive following Hamas's attack. But a rising death count in the besieged enclave, enormous pro-Palestinian protests across the globe, and increasing discomfort inside the White House has put strain on the US's posture. Apparently, this is according to CNN. But steady pressure by the Biden administration on Israel to refine its war plans has not yet yielded the level of clarity many US officials want. More than 11,000 Palestinians have been killed since October the 7th. That's in just over a month, Martin. But this recording has emerged. I'm not sure whether you think it's genuine or not, General Petraeus discussing this topic. Have you seen this? Have you heard it?
No, I'd be interested to see what he's got to say. I'm sure I'm going to disagree with it.
Well,
let's hear it.
CIA Bilderberger Iraq war guy. So he's he's not Blinken. He's the military guy who's kind of talking off the record and
He's retired now, so he can say what he likes.
Well, yeah, but this is apparently a recording of him over there in a secret conversation with the Israelis. So let's have a listen to that.
I see no alternative to the destruction of Hamas, and I use that term specifically because, as Aviv knows, there's a military doctrinal term. It's a gradation. You know, you can disrupt, you can deny, you can defeat, you can destroy. I think that it has to be destroyed. Destruction means, in military terms, that you are rendering an enemy incapable of accomplishing his mission without reconstitution. Keep in mind the reconstitution piece, because this is a huge task for the day after, for the ultimate administration of Gaza. I think that the vision that is announced by the Prime Minister, ultimately with the IDF chief of staff by his side and others, should be that to make clear the intent to destroy Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and then to lay out how this has to be done. There is no alternative, I'm sure Aviva will agree, literally, to going progressively, methodically through, starting with Gaza City in the north. But ultimately, it's going to have to be the entire area of Gaza over time if it is truly to be destroyed. And there will still be, of course, remnants of Hamas and Pidge that Iran will seek and will try to enable to come back. And so we'll have to focus on that in a moment. I think there needs to be an explanation of how this is going to be done that stresses purity of arms. Again, the Israeli terminology for essentially the Geneva Convention, the laws of land warfare, that has to be stressed. Several of you have noted, again, the growing concern for Palestinian civilians. This will have to be very clearly demonstrated, you know, during the battles, that Israeli soldiers are taking great pains to safeguard civilians, noting that, of course, this is an enemy without a uniform, hides among civilians, has hostages. There are going to be suicide bombers. There will be improvised explosive devices. You know all this, booby traps, rooms that blow up, buildings that blow up, etc. But it's going to have to be methodically and very carefully done. And, of course, it's going to have to emphasize clear and hold. As Aviv knows, if you clear and just go on to the next building and don't leave a sizable force behind, the enemy will re-infiltrate behind you, and you're going to be fighting in 360 degrees. You have to, again, do this very, very methodically and hang on to the areas. And then I would submit that it should begin to rebuild as quickly as is possible. As soon as an area is reasonably safe, there should be a demonstration of the intention to start repairing the damage and destruction. And that leads to another element of the vision, which has to be what life can be like for the Palestinians in Gaza, and I'd submit in the West Bank while they're at it, noting that the domestic political issues in Israel may make this slightly idealistic. But again, we did this when we're carrying out operations to clear al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Islamic State, where we'd tell the Sunni Arabs, if you reject them, if you help us against them — I'm not expecting the Palestinians to help you against them, but at least not to actively support them, and to stay out of the way — and then perhaps life, not only perhaps, life will be better after Hamas. Hamas has brought this on you.
So that's a supposedly secret recording of David Petraeus. So, Martin, it does sound as if it's perfectly genuine. The guy he's referring to, Aviv — I'll put a link up to this, a full version of that, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. One of the top Israeli officials certainly does seem to be genuine.
Well, I'm fairly familiar with Petraeus' views on things, and that stuff, that was fairly consistent with the sort of thing he says. Don't forget, he's the guy that lost the war in Iraq and lost the war in Afghanistan, and he's advising the Israelis how to defeat Hamas. It's extraordinary. I mean, Martyanov, the Russian blogger that I read, who's a Russian naval officer, he just regards all US top military as incompetent and blowhards.
Well, he's saying effectively there's no alternative to blasting through Gaza until you've got rid of everybody in Hamas. Well, that might mean that 95 or even 99% of the people you're killing are just innocent civilians.
Well, that's true. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, Tony. We had to bomb Dresden. You remember there was an Israeli minister saying, well, it's like bombing Dresden.
Well, this week, Jeremy Bowen, the BBC correspondent, was embedded with the Israeli Defence Force in Gaza.
The Israeli army took our BBC team close to Gaza City in an armoured vehicle, on condition that my reporting did not give away military positions. We also had to agree to military censorship of video material, though not this radio report. We travelled through an area that had been left a wasteland after a month of airstrikes and just over a week of a ground invasion. I didn't see a single building that wasn't badly damaged or destroyed. I also didn't see a single Palestinian civilian. There were spasmodic blasts of Israeli tank shells and bursts of machine gun fire. The Israelis took us to a wrecked three-story building in the remains of a big housing development. On a ground sheet, they spread out components they said were partly assembled drones that were designed to bomb them. Then they showed off two floors of workshops. The military called it a terror factory. On the third floor of the badly damaged building was a family apartment, including a bedroom with three pink child's beds, as well as dolls and other toys. The deputy commander of the 4th Armoured Brigade, Lieutenant Colonel Ido — I'm not permitted to use his full name — said that was proof that Hamas used Palestinian civilians as human shields. When I asked the Lieutenant Colonel about the thousands of civilians who've been killed in Israeli strikes in Gaza, he rejected any suggestion that the Israel Defense Forces, as the military is known here, was responsible.
The IDF does not aim to kill innocent people. There's Hamas all over. It's hard to identify the Hamas. I've been shot before an hour and a half. An RPG hit my tank before an hour and a half. From nowhere. They came from a tunnel, tried to kill me. If I see civilians here, I'll do all that is in my power not to harm them.
The visit to Gaza left two overriding impressions. The first is the vast amount of military power Israel has brought in to fight the ground war. I saw many troops and tanks. The second is the level of destruction. It will be extremely difficult for anyone to return to live in the wrecked districts I was able to see. It was on the same level of destruction that I witnessed in the wars in Syria and Ukraine.
So the BBC's Jeremy Bowen there, speaking on the 6 o'clock news bulletin earlier this week. And he sounds uncomfortable, doesn't he? He's saying, oh, I'm going in with the tanks, but I'm really not sure I trust these guys.
Well, that's right. And if, interestingly enough, of course, there have been more Palestinian civilians killed in the last month than have been killed by both sides in the Ukraine war, which has been raging for 2.5 years. So it just shows you what the difference is. The Ukrainians have killed quite a lot of civilians because the Bucha massacre was probably them, not the Russians.
Butcher.
Bucha, the Bucha massacre, yeah. But the Israelis either A, don't care about civilian casualties, although the far right in Israel actually welcome Palestinian
civilian
casualties.
Okay, let's go back to EL.
They want to exterminate.
Hulata, ex-chair of the National Security Council, who run these sorts of wars and things over in Israel, speaking to Evan Davis.
What went wrong? I know there will be obviously massive national inquest into all of that, but your sort of thoughts after October 7th.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, I think everybody feels it's on their watch. Even the fact that I finished my role 10 months ago, I think there is no Israeli who dealt with that, who doesn't ask himself what went wrong and why. And I think that this is very important because the responsibility goes from all the way to the bottom, of course, all the way to the top. And this is an increasingly important question looking into the future. Hamas was in a better understanding than what we thought in understanding our collection efforts, and they were able to run a counterintelligence campaign that was very effective because we knew that they were making plans. We knew that they had procedures to go through the fence, and we knew that they wanted to kidnap soldiers and civilians if they can. At least when I was national security advisor, we did not conceive that this would be so massive, so brutal. I guess we didn't want to think that they were able to do something and that they would be willing to do something that, you know, so horrific that we haven't seen in the history of Israel. But clearly, on the tactical side, they were able to deceive us, to blind us, and to go ahead with it. And this is very unfortunate. I mean, you know, everybody is asking, how can this happen to Israel? And I say, number one, it shouldn't have. We should have been better, and we will learn from our mistakes and be better. At the same note, I'm saying, if it happened to us, you know, it can happen in other places and other spheres of, because we were very, very attentive. And I think you also see from how the ground operation is going on now, you know, you can understand we have pretty good intel if we're able to do all the things that we're doing without getting into all those traps. And it's very, very, very unfortunate and agonizing that we have to go through that.
Well, I mean, they're bigging up how successful they're being at killing Hamas. Obviously, I don't know what they're doing exactly, but the military analysis that I read suggests that they're not being very successful at capturing Hamas. They've killed loads and loads of civilians, but Hamas are in tunnels underneath Gaza. They've got their fighters are all dug into those tunnels. And what Petraeus was saying earlier, you know, as we advance into Gaza, they might pop up behind us. That's because they're in tunnels. So you wait for the Israelis to roll over, and then they're carrying on going forward, and then you pop up behind them. Now, the other thing that may well happen, and we'll have to see what happens this week, is that Hezbollah may open up. I mean, they're already fighting the Israelis. People are being killed in the northern front of this war. And the Israelis have had to withdraw people from all of the settlements from the north part of Israel. They've all been evacuated. And then what that means is that Hezbollah have captured effectively the north of Israel. People can't stay there anymore. And Hezbollah haven't even started fighting yet. Now, if Hezbollah comes into fight, which they may do, that's when the Americans and the British are going to start attacking Lebanon and Syria. But that's the point at which the Russian Air Force comes into play. The Russians are deploying their Kinzhal missiles on their top planes over the Black Sea because they can sink both of those US aircraft carriers. Now, at that point, Joe Biden turns around and Rishi Sunak turns around. We're all going to war, people. And I think that in actual fact, most people in Britain, not necessarily the United States, where the Israelis have such a stranglehold, will not feel that that is a sensible policy by the British government.
Hundreds of journalists have slammed the media coverage of Gaza for enabling Israeli massacre this week. This is from the Committee to Protect Journalists, I think. An open letter signed by over 750 journalists, including those from mainstream Western outlets, slams the Israeli government for killing civilians and journalists in Gaza. The signatories condemn newsrooms for failing to give the Palestinians a fair voice, justifying the Israeli onslaught, signed by journalists at Reuters, the Los Angeles Times, the Jewish Currents, MSNBC, Bloomberg, the Boston Globe and Washington Post blast Israel for its devastating bombing campaign and media blockade in Gaza, which threatens news gathering in an unprecedented fashion as reporters, editors, photographers, producers and other workers in newsrooms around the world were appalled at the slaughter of our colleagues and their families by the Israeli military and government. The letter reads, "We're writing to urge an end to the violence against journalists. Committee to Protect Journalists reports that since the start of military operations, 34 Palestinian journalists have been killed. The Israeli bombing campaign is the deadliest war on journalists since the Committee to Protect Journalists began collecting data in 1992. Now, the actual figure, I believe, in total now for the journalists is around about 50 have been killed. So the idea here is you can't report from Gaza if we're going to bomb you.
Well, one of the journalists who was reporting from Gaza for Al Jazeera, they deliberately targeted his family, killed his wife.
How
and
do you know it was deliberate?
That's what people are saying. They don't forget the Israelis have got precision weaponry.
May have been an accident.
No, they've got precision weaponry. They claim all the time that they're using precision weaponry. That is exactly what they claim. So they're choosing these targets. And they chose to target his family with a precision weapon.
And the rockets are still coming out of Gaza, apparently, to hit Tel Aviv.
At the moment, yeah, but when Hezbollah opens up, all of the civilian infrastructure in Israel is going to be smashed, and so are their military bases. At that point, the US are flying airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against the militants that are opposing them in those two countries. And we're drifting towards a full-on war. The Russians don't want to join in, and nor do the Iranians. But if they carry on down this road, that is what is going to happen. And I think people in this country need to have a word with themselves, Tory MPs particularly.
Well,
because we are about to go to war with Russia and Iran because of this.
I don't think they are having words with themselves. I think they've just decided they're taking sides. And in fact, they have this kind of weird religious zeal for the bad guys somehow. I mean, maybe they've been got at, God knows. But anyway,
I think
Michael Svard is an Israeli human rights lawyer, and he popped up on the Peston show this week. He had some quite interesting stuff to say. I'll put a full link to this interview too up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Michael Svard.
Nothing prepared neither me nor my colleagues and Israeli civil society to what's happening in the last month since October 7th. Only a couple of hours ago, the Israeli High Court has upheld a decision of the Israeli police not to allow two demonstrations that were about to kick off in different Israeli cities against the war and in solidarity with the victims of Gaza. And this is unprecedented in Israeli terms. Freedom of speech has always been the cornerstone of Israeli constitutional order. What we've seen in the last month is a crackdown on every dissenting voices you can find in Israel. And when I say dissent, I don't just mean those who think that the war should not be waged or not this way. I'm also talking about people who very naively just posted statements expressing sympathy to the people of Gaza or criticism of how Israel is waging its war. We've seen hundreds, really hundreds of arrests that are all based on speech. We've seen hundreds of students being suspended or summoned for hearings prior to suspension from their universities, and employees being warned that their job will be terminated because of statements they've made that does not correspond to the line. It's really something, and of course, incitement, unbelievable, vicious incitement against human rights defenders, mainly against the Palestinian minority in Israel, Israelis, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, who are targeted by the Israeli right in a way that that is just horrific, really.
Can I just ask you on that? When it comes down to clamping down on freedom of expression, we've seen extraordinary statements by some on the right. I mean, there was even a member of the government who talked about nuking Gaza. Yeah. Have these people effectively been able to make those sorts of inciting statements with impunity?
Look, I for one do not believe, as some people say, that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. I have many criticism and I have my own concerns about what's going on in Gaza. But definitely Israel is saturated with genocidal incitement by politicians, by journalists, by social media influencers, by celebrities, And nothing is done to any of them. People are talking openly about, you know, erasing Gaza, about ethnic cleansing of Gaza, about deporting all the Gazans, about not caring about who are civilians and who are combatants. And this just goes with complete impunity. And this is, it adds up to the very, very active fashion in which the authorities are tackling those on the other side who have criticism of the government and the military operations.
Well, I think he probably knows a little bit more about human rights law than Sir Keir Starmer. He seems to be drilling into that quite well, Martin. He stops short of saying that what's happening in Gaza is genocide, but he's saying there is certainly incitement to genocide from loads of parts of the far right all across Israeli society.
Well, that's right. And I think that people in the West...
Michael Svard, that is, by the way. And I'll put a link to the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Well, the statements coming out of the Israeli government are appalling. I think it's incumbent upon the British government to say, well, we're not happy with what your minister just said there about using nuclear weapons in Gaza.
They're also annoying...
Why should we go along with that?
Annoying the UN quite a bit as well, aren't they?
So when I was responsible for what was the world's biggest humanitarian relief operation during the war in Yemen, when the Saudi-led coalition were carpet bombing the country, what we did was we told the coalition every day all of the hundreds of convoys and trucks and clinics and so on we were operating. And we sat down in a room with them and we said, this is what we're going to do. And the deal was they had to make sure that they didn't interfere with or bomb the operation. And so what needs to happen is, in this case, has to be the Israeli authorities need to sit down in a room with the aid agencies and have that discussion. So one day there'll be a convoy down this road, the next day it'll be a clinic in that village, right, and it will be a continuous process and it has to run all the time. You know,
So the UN wouldn't need to talk to Hamas for this?
The threat actually doesn't come from Hamas. Let me just make a point, Robert, about the importance of this. In its first 75 years, the UN lost an average of two aid workers killed a year. Mm. In the last 3.5 weeks, it's lost 60 people.
Cranky.
There is a huge danger to the aid operation.
Yeah.
And safe arrangements need to be put in place to save those more than 2 million people who are running out of food and clean water and life's other essentials.
So that's Mark Lowcock, former head of UN Humanitarian Aid, speaking last week on that Pessin show. Guterres this week, Martin, saying that Gaza is a graveyard for children. That's what it's become.
Well, Guterres, of course, the Israelis went to the UN General Assembly and said that he should be sacked and that the UN had no future role.
I mean, it doesn't seem as if they...
that's their view. That's
surely,
the arrogance
surely
of their
Israelis,
view.
The Israelis surely want to try and at least get the UN to go. I mean, they don't seem to be interested in persuading them.
Well, they've never been interested in persuading the UN because they know that public opinion around the world, particularly in developing countries, is absolutely hostile to what they've been doing. And they've not made any friends at all since all of this kicked off.
A lot of this is to do with anti-Semitism, and their big argument is, oh, well, the people who are against us, including Hamas, just want to kill Jews. Scott Ritter had something to say about that this week, too.
I'm here to defend people who worship trees. I'm here to defend people who worship butterflies. I'm here to people who say they don't want to worship, and I'm here to people who believe in the Torah, who believe in the Quran, who believe in the Bible, the New Testament, you know, the whole thing. If it's your shtick, I'm here to defend you, because that's what makes this country the greatest country in the world, or at least the country with the greatest potential to be the greatest country in the world, because we're not living up to it, man. We are failing across the board, and one of the greatest failures we have in this is the way that the pro-Zionist lobby uses being a Jew as a weapon. They weaponize this aspect of it, and that's far more dangerous to the Jewish community than anything else that's going on here, because they are creating it by saying that everything is anti-Semitism. You are putting the Jews against everybody, and that inherently creates the conditions for, you know, animosity. That may not be anti-Semitic in nature. It might just be because we're really pissed off at these people for getting us involved in another war. It doesn't have to do anything with you being Jewish. It has to do everything with the policies that you're undertaking that are dragging my country down to war.
Scott Ritter, of course, is ex-military, and he has done loads of work. You know, he basically was cooperating, liaising with the Israeli military when he was in the US Marines. And his recent stuff, he said, well, I'm never going to stand with Israel again now after this. In the past, I've defended them, and I've had, you know, I've had a view that they, you know, they're entitled to certain consideration. But because of what they've done now, I'm finished with that. I'm not going to treat them in that way at all in the future.
Yeah. I remember having a chat with Scott actually, and him talking about maybe the links between what's going on in Ukraine and Israel. He said, hey, that's outside my comfort zone. But now it obviously is not. He's back in his comfort zone, or it certainly is. He's in his comfort zone. Another brilliant bit of work has been done by the Al Jazeera channel, Martin, this week, looking into Israel's claims that that Hamas are hiding underneath the hospitals. Well, they've been did a very, I mean, an excellent little bit of forensic investigation to find that actually the so-called Hamas base under one of the hospitals that they were bombing was in fact a water tank.
Yes, it is just lies. I mean, a lot of what's been going on is just lies. Like
I'll put
the 40,
a link up to that
the
report,
40 beheaded
anyway.
Babies, yeah. Just lies. And the same in the Ukraine. They just come out with lies, and then they say, yes, it was a lie, but we're not lying now. When people lie, you know that they're lying. Everything is a lie. In any case, even if there was a Hamas tunnel underneath a hospital, is it legitimate to bomb the hospital and kill the pregnant women and elderly people dying in the hospital, supposedly to try and hit a Hamas bunker underneath the hospital?
I don't know if you saw this stuff about the last weekend at the Al-Shifa hospital, where they'd taken them days and days to arrange to get 150 or so of the most seriously ill patients out through the Rafah crossing into Egypt. As the convoy left, the first ambulance in the convoy was bombed from the air by the Israelis about 5 minutes after the convoy going to Rafah had left. So they made a decision to look, this is crazy, let's just go back to the hospital. As the convoy of ambulances with 150 seriously ill patients was arriving back at the Al-Shifa hospital, the Israelis bombed the convoy again.
Well, that's the same happened when they said to people to flee to the south of Gaza. People were on a lorry fleeing to the south of Gaza, as instructed by the IDF, and then they bombed the lorry and killed 70 people.
So I'll put a link up, by the way, to, because Al Jazeera did a fantastic, I think it's Inside Story, it's called Live, last Saturday evening, into that incident, talking to various humanitarian aid workers in, I think one of them was actually over in Egypt, another one was actually in the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza.
You know what happened yesterday exactly, that the Shifa hospital is overcrowded. We have more than 2,000 patients now in the hospital. And thanks to the Egyptian, they approved to get us less than 100 patients to be evacuated to Egypt. So the ICRC and the UN, everyone refused to arrange for this patient transport as per the international law. And then we found no way here to get the patients transported from Shifa Hospital to Rafah border, so from the middle of Gaza to the south of Gaza. So the ministry, after a few days of waiting, has decided that we will move this group of ambulances, and we will inform everyone that this ambulance will move at this certain time from Shifa Hospital through Rashid, which is the beach, the main coastal road, down to Rafah borders. And they informed everyone what happened. They started moving from Shifa Hospital in 2 or 3 minutes' time in Ansar roundabout. They just bombed the first ambulance. And then the whole group decided to go back to Shifa Hospital. When they arrived to Shifa entrance, they bombed another hospital, another ambulance. And we got at least 15 people killed in that attack.
And his testimony was some of the most powerful television I've ever seen being produced by Al Jazeera, explaining, look, this is a hospital here, and we're getting our most serious injured patients, and they're just being killed by Israeli aircraft bombs.
I think the strategy of the IDF is either to kill everybody in Gaza or kill as many as possible, because they're snakes, of course, you know, they're not human beings. And then, if we can get the Rafah crossing open, we can then resettle them, or can just push them into Egypt. The problem with that is the Egyptian government won't go along with it. And in any case, any times the Rafah crossing has been bombed by the Israelis, which is why it's been closed. The problem for them is that the Israeli military government, which is what it is, cannot do that because their main opposition inside Egypt itself, they've got 40,000 political prisoners, is guess what? The Muslim Brotherhood. And what are Hamas? They are members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Anyway, I spoke to Johnny Vedmore this week in quite a long interview, a sort of 20-25 minute long interview, but here's a little clip from it where he's done a recent investigation which I think he's going to be talking about tonight or tomorrow on his programme, which is, I think he's involved with the Unlimited Hangout, which is Whitney Webb's thing. Anyway, Johnny always does a good job, and here he is looking at the genetic right of return. This is the idea that the Israeli government, this Greater Israel Project people's genetics have been looked at, and the Palestinians are actually from that part of the world, and they are not.
If you saw a report a couple of days ago on, I think it was Sky News, it was the first reporters that were allowed in with the Israel Defense Force, and they went to a town just over the border in Gaza, and they've just completely and utterly destroyed it. It's like there's no way that every single house had a tunnel. There's no way that every single house had a Hamas fighter. There was no way there was probably any resistance. On a border town, it's likely Hamas withdrew their soldiers to a more convenient spot for an urban battle so that they could save their fighters instead of them being taken out in the first town that the Israel Defense Force is going to come across. But this town was flattened, and it's obviously been flattened to make way for the kibbutz that's going to be put in its place. This is now the end game. This is a real sick end game as well, because I mean, we can all see it, and it's all hypernormalization. We all know the lines really well, and I went away and said, okay, what doesn't feel right? There was a constant reoccurring theme that I noticed, which was that the Palestinians, it's not like they're not given a right to exist now. Yeah, they're not, Israel isn't going to say, and the rest of the world and their supporters aren't going to say, oh, look, the Palestinians, we're not giving them a right to exist and they don't have a right to exist. So of course they're going to say, no, they have a right to exist and et cetera. But what I saw is there's a much more esoteric argument happening, which is they don't have a right to ever have existed. They don't have a right to have been Palestinian people in the first place. Before 1948, there was no Palestine. Before 1948, there was no people there. Before 1948, there was no Palestinian people living on the land or people living on the land. Before 1948, there was a whole empty area where it was only this many people and only this. And it's a lie. It's a lie. I've gone back and looked at a lot of the truth. And one thing that really has changed my opinion of the whole affair was discovering the genetics. I think that is the key. You see, this esoteric idea of the Palestinians never existed in the first place and no one was there. And it's like denying someone's right to ever have existed, not to exist now, but ever have existed. It's so hard to understand why that would happen. If you look at the genetics of Palestinian people, they're 50 to 80% related to the Canaanite people, the Canaanites from the ancient past. They're 50 to 80% related to Bronze Age Canaanite people. The Palestinian people are exactly in the place the Palestinian people should be in. They're in their homeland, the homeland of Canaan, that was there but predates the Kingdom of Israel and the Kingdom of Judah. Now, that argument would just, of course, you know, fall into a headbutt, or to merge into a headbutting argument against big bulls who are shouting over each other anyway. But what you discover then, if you look at the genetic testing of all of Jewish people in general, Israelis in general, you discover they're 50+% related to Canaanites. They were a mixed multitude that came from Egypt. They were not all Jewish. They created a load of narratives behind them in their past. But what you see is Canaanite cousin fighting Canaanite cousin. And both of them have some form of claim to that territory. They do. That's why it's happening. But the fact that this one idea that's being pushed, to change people's minds, that the Palestinian people never existed, there is no such thing as the state of Palestine, that is a lie.
Johnny Vedmore there talking to me yesterday, and put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He talks about all sorts of fascinating stuff, including the Israeli Nicole Junkerman's role in digitising the National Health Service, which is a whole thing in itself, as the actual operations aren't taking place. The money seems to be going on some sort of digital NHS, which doesn't really work. Martin, what do you make of this whole genetic argument? This is something that we've broached on this show a few times.
Well, some years ago, there was a BBC Two documentary, I think it was a Horizon documentary, which was looking into exactly this. What are the genetic origins of the current Israeli population? Now, the first thing you should point out is that quite a large proportion of Israelis have emigrated from somewhere else. They weren't born in Israel.
Eastern Europe, mostly.
Eastern Europe, there's lots of Russians, for example. Yeah. Loads of Russians.
In fact, Netanyahu's is a Polish family.
Yes, he isn't called Netanyahu. He's got a Polish name, which he gave up. Yuri Avenry, who I mentioned the other week, he was born in Germany, in Frankfurt. So he's German. So lots of these people actually have got roots elsewhere. But because we've now got the genetic capacity to, just having a swab in somebody's mouth, we can genuinely say now what people are genetically. And what was very interesting about this program, which was going to be shown on BBC Two, was that many European Jews are not, in fact, related. They haven't got Semitic DNA at all. What they've got is Tartar DNA. The Tartar Khanate, which used to exist in Crimea and north of there, they converted to Judaism in the 9th century. Because north of them was the Orthodox Russians, and to the south of them were Muslims, and they wanted to have a religion. They were basically animist people, they were from the steppe, but they realized our state needs a religion, so they converted to Judaism. Many of those Jews, and that, of course you can convert to Judaism, yeah, which is another ridiculous thing about this. Anybody can convert to Judaism, and then they're Jewish, aren't they? You have to be circumcised and all the rest of it, but that can be done. And they converted to Judaism, and of course many of those people ended up in the shtetls in Eastern Europe. Yeah, the Khazars lived in Lithuania, for example. Now these people, in fact, never lived in Israel, but the Palestinian population, they are, in fact, descended from the original Jews, but they converted either to Christianity, Greek Orthodox Christianity during the Roman Empire, or later on, they converted to Islam. But genetically, they are the original Jews.
Well,
and the Khazars, who are actually the dominant in the Ashkenazi elite in Israel, are not. And of course, it wasn't allowed to be shown. The Jewish lobby, the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby, lobbied the BBC, and that documentary was never shown. Because in actual fact, it's pretty uncontroversial.
Anyone with any knowledge about any copies of that, it would be nice to get it out to our listeners and make it available for people to watch. If
it
that's
doesn't make
feasible.
Any difference,
we're speaking,
it's interesting, but it doesn't make any difference.
Just looking at Middle East Eye, which has been extremely good, along with Middle East Monitor, on this topic of Gaza. Heavy Israeli shelling near Gaza's Al Shifa Hospital tonight. Street battles reported as Israel escalates attacks on hospitals and. Israeli troops have encircled Gaza hospitals, bombing Al Shifa again. So I just ask you, I mean, imagine Al Jazeera will be doing something on this tomorrow evening or Saturday evening. And this is, I mean, it's a particularly horrific genocide where as people are injured in these bomb attacks, completely unnecessary civilian attacks, the Israelis then wait for them to be concentrated in a hospital and then bomb the hospital.
Well, there was a slogan, I seem to remember it, never again. It is again. We're there. It's happening in front of us, and our government and the leader of the opposition are complicit.
Okay, so we're going to wind up tonight with Jana Ben-Nun on True News from Florida, talking about, which I thought was quite an interesting take on this, about the actual plans, the real plans underneath the various onion skins and bits of onion peel of the Israeli policies, related to something called the Zohar and the Kabbalah.
Kabbalah, the entire thing is separation of people to Israelitic and non-Israelitic according to the book called Jewish Utopia. Now, they are building their own kingdom. It's the Jewish earthly kingdom with headquarters in Jerusalem where their AI Messiah will be, and they're going to rule the world through the law. You know, it will be international, one law. One religion, basically, Luciferian religion. So yes, in a Talmud, this is the Jewish earthly kingdom, and this is why Zionist Christianity have embraced Kiliasm,
which means 1,000.
Where
they get the 1,000-year millennial reign.
Exactly, which is a focus on earthly millennial kingdom, and this is how Jews and Christians are getting together, and Christians are so deceived, thinking that they are working for the good thing, for the Jews, like they're helping the Jews. The Jews are supposed to get this kingdom. Yet this is Zoharic doctrine, and it does not have good intention. As I said, that they want to rule the world, they want to get Gentile riches, and they want to rule the Gentiles. They don't consider Gentiles fully human beings. And in fact, as an end game, they have this strange doctrine, Adam Kadmon doctrine, which Adam Kadmon originally was, according to Zohar and Talmud, he was androgynous. You know,
Adam,
like he was male, female in one body. And this is why you see this transgender agenda today. And there are laws, very serious laws, passing in Alberta, Canada.
Is Zionism behind the transgender movement?
You know, I don't think that, personally, I don't think Zionist Christians are aware of this. They're not aware of many details. But I think that, yes.
Does the transgender movement get its origin in Zionism?
Yes, it gets its origin in Zionism, and it gets its origin in the Talmud, Zohar, and Kabbalah. It's a Kabbalistic doctrine of Adam Kadmon. Eventually, they have this doctrine called Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. Yes. So how do they want to repair the world? They want to bring it to the original. Who was original? Adam. He was androgynous. So now they're putting specific things in food and drink, and they're basically, their end game is to make humans that on earth that will survive whatever it is they're bringing, androgynous, transgender agenda.
What they're really trying to do is undo God's creation.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, so that is Jana Ben-Nun on True News talking about hidden agendas, Kabbalistic hidden agendas. I think it's the sort of thing I would quite like to run past, I'm sure we all would, David Livingstone. So maybe we're going to be hearing again from him next week. Netanyahu most definitely has been chatting to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. That is the particular type of rabbis over in Israel, who the idea there is that they want to rebuild the Third Temple, and that, I'm afraid, will bring in apparently the Jewish Messiah. Quite what that will look like, and whether it's like what we were hearing from Jana Ben-Nun there, who knows? Time to sign off anyway. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Bristol City Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and the Tory Party, Jeff Gollop, and of course freelance journalist Joe Banks and sound engineer Dave Bozenko. Do download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram and do share stuff there, or send me interviews, story tips via the email not the BCFM Politics Show page. We'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page and our email addresses. By the way, if you're sending anything in as a Gmailer, please don't. It's much better to use a non-Gmail account. I've noticed somebody last week was asking me to what my details were to set up a standing order to put money into the bank account here. And, of course, it's a Gmail address. Many of the Gmails, which I just phone, you know, contact them by other means, including trying to do Zoom calls and things. If I send it to a Gmail address, it doesn't get there. So please boycott Gmail. Don't use Gmail. Set up another one, a Proton Mail or something like that, because if I'm emailing you at a Gmail account, chances are you'll never see anything, because they're just putting emails from me in the bin, and probably many, many other people too, because they're abusing their power to do that by saying, oh, it's spam or something. Anyway, you can subscribe, as I say, to the weekly email list, which is a newsletter, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You can also get hold of the paperbacks about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II. That's The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. It also talks about the origin of the Bilderberg. You'll understand entirely what Bilderberg is about if you get that. It costs £15 for the paperback copy. And also I do a book, The Siege of Heaven Reader, which has got a picture of a kiddie with a cow tag in its ear on the front. Which is looking at the occult government since the English Civil War, right the way up to, it's quite a bit on the Princess Diana assassination too. Haven't even mentioned our wife murdering King, at least saying the fact that he is, because certainly that's what the evidence appears to show, that whilst he was Prince Charles, he decided, right, we're not going to have this woman around anymore, and so they staged an accident over in Paris to get rid of Diana. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available from Apple and Android stores. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.